is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History, for the week starting October 6th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. This Week in Radical History for October 7th.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
In 1879, labor organizer Joe Hill is born. He'd be killed on this date by the state of Utah after a sham trial. He wired his labor organizer's friends these words: I'd like to die a true blue rebel. Don't waste any more time mourning. Organize. And his last words in front of the firing squad was, fire.
San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill.
And it is right here where you will find more radical history. Like on October 7th in 1909, letting all principals know what's up, the U.S. consulate reports a revolution against the Nicaraguan government will begin on October 8th. Also on this date in 1934 in Brazil, green shirt fascists in Sao Paulo attempt to mimic Mussolini's march on Rome, only to be scattered in disarray when confronted by the anarchists and farm workers, who unite in opposition to the fascists. Also on this date in 1969, the Haymarket statue, a memorial to cops slain who fired on workers in 1886 in Chicago, is bombed, reported to be bombed by the Weather Underground. The mayor rebuilds the statue, and it is bombed again next year. Learning his lesson, the mayor rebuilds it again and has to place a 24-hour guard around the statue. Also on this date in 1969, black football players at the University of Wyoming are kicked off the team for protesting against the Mormons of Utah State for segregation at Brigham Young University. Also on October 7, 1987, religious zealous and hypocrite Pat Robinson acknowledges to the Wall Street Journal report that he's been less than candid about his wedding date and his first child was born only 10 weeks after his marriage. He follows a long line before him and after him, like Family Values man Ronald Reagan, who married his second wife Nancy, who had a baby 7 months after that, and hypocrite VP candidate Palin shotgun weddings. In your face, Christian Family Values. Two more items for October 7th, 1990. Justice Department reports U.S. prison population doubled in the last 10 years. Worst in the Western world. Yeah, we're number one. We're number one. Lastly, in 1993, Guatemala, a mass grave of 150 women and children murdered by the U.S.-supported and trained Guatemala Army is opened. The U.S. government documents released in 1999 describes in chilling detail, often in cold bureaucratic language, how American advisors and their Cold War obsession spurred on the killing and hid the horrible secrets from the public. This Week in Radical History for October 8th, only got a couple items. 1871, Mrs. O'Leary's cow starts a Chicago fire in the evening, kills over 200 and over 98,000 left homeless as 3.5 square miles of the city burn to the ground. As Chicago blazes away some 200 miles to the south, an even deadlier fire rips through Peshtigo, Wisconsin, completely razing to the town and killing 600 of its inhabitants. Over 1 million acres of forest was also consumed. Also for October 8, 1976, President Ford signs a bill to terminate Indian Claims Commission, ending any mechanism for repayment of land stolen from the tribes. In the year 2000, over 1,000 protesters gather to oppose Hong Kong's law prohibiting public demonstration by more than 30 people without permission of Officer Friendly. You know, why not do what freedom-loving, protecting United States does and give protesters free speech zones, nice pendant areas to express themselves? Also in the year 2000, that date, hey Saddam, beat this. American government releases documents showing it tested chemical and biological weapons in the open air in Alaska, Hawaii, Alberta, Canada, and Great Britain. We're number one. We're number one. This Week in Radical History for October 9th. breaking the myth once again that America was founded on religious freedoms. In 1635, Roger Williams, a member of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, an outspoken critic of the ill treatment of Native Americans, is banished from the colonies for, quote, religious heresy, unquote.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 9th in 1823, black American abolitionist and newspaper publisher Mary Ann Shad Carey was born in Wilmington, Delaware. When Mary was 17 years old, she opened a school for black children in Pennsylvania. 10 years later, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed and Mary moved to Canada, where she founded a racially integrated school, as well as establishing the Provincial Freeman, a newspaper that attacked slavery and promoted the education of blacks. After moving back to the U.S., Mary graduated from Howard Law School, becoming the second black woman in the U.S. to graduate with a law degree. During her career as a lawyer, Mary Ann Shad worked hard to achieve voting rights for women in America. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on this date in 1936, during the Lettuce Strike in Salinas, California, red flags appeared around town, specifically at intersections and power poles. Fearing communists, the local authorities took down the flags, only discovered later that they were part of a traffic check being made by the State Highway Division. Oops. Also on this date in 1969, 2,500 National Guard called into Chicago, Illinois, for the 9th through the 11th during the Weather Underground Days of Rage protest. For a great movie on the Weather Underground, to see a pretty reasonable evolution and delusion of political uprising in this country, see the Academy Award nominated movie from 2 years ago, also called Weather Underground. Also on October 9th, 1970 in England, the Italian Trade Center, Exhibition Building, Cork Street, London is bombed. Attacks simultaneously happen in Manchester, Birmingham, Paris, and against Italian state buildings. The attacks were claimed on behalf of an Italian anarchist murdered by the police in 1969, part of a large series of bombings for this year, believed to be attributed to the Anarchist Angry Brigade. Two more items were October 9th, 1983. James Watts resigns as Reagan's Secretary of the Interior after referring to his appointment of a black, a woman, two Jews, and a cripple. Early in this week, one of Reagan's aides also pleads guilty to the involvement in the weapons for hostage trade Iran-Contra scandal.
We talk without words, and everybody understands. Just desserts, delivered by hand. Nobody move, or the CEO hits it in the face with cream and dough. See the scramble
to the top. Lastly, for October 9th, 1998, neoliberal economist Milton Friedman gets just desserts at the Marriott Hotel in San Francisco during the School Choice and Corporate America Conference. The Triple B field agents, custard and lemon meringue, approached him and let fly with tofu cream and sweet potato pies. Just desserts, delivered by hand. This week in Radical History for October 10th, 1609 in England. Jared Winstanley, founder of the Diggers, is born. The Diggers attempted to reform by leveling real property, the existing social order of the time, with an agrarian lifestyle based upon their ideas of the creation of a small, egalitarian rural communities. Their use of public lands in England enraged the local manor owners and townspeople, and the government would eventually put them all down. Here's a song about the Diggers written by Winstanley at the time, sung by the anarchist group Chumbawamba.
Stand up now, you noble diggers, all stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now. With spades and hoes and plough, stand up now, with spades and hoes and plough, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers of old, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now.
To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise. The devil in them lies, and have blinded both their eyes. Stand up now, the clergy they come in. Stand up now, the clergy they come in. Stand up now. The clergy they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round. Stand up now, the gentry are all round. Stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, the club is all their law. Stand up now, the club is all their law. Stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe, that they no vision saw, to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all.
A couple more items for October 10th, 1954 in Guatemala. CIA-sponsored Colonel Carlos Armas becomes president, via democracy, America style. Also 1960, Irish poet and playwright Brendan Meehan appears on Jack Parr's show and famously says, "I've never seen a situation so dismal that the police can't make it worse." Also, the diggers are back in the news, only this time 350 years later in 1966, when the modern-day version of the diggers, founded in San Francisco, start distributing free food at the Golden Gate Park. Lastly, in 1990, reparation payments begin to survivors and families of the Japanese Americans taken from their homes and put into concentration camps during World War II. In the entire course of the war, 10 people would be convicted of spying for Japan, all of whom are Caucasians. That score again, folks, Caucasians 10, Asians 0. This week in Radical History for October 11th, 1910, Nicaragua, three generals and U.S. company officials form a governing junta to protect the American interests. Also on that date in 1958, the second attempt to send a rocket around the moon fails when its excessively high trajectory causes it to fall back to Earth. The U.S. space program, however, will improve under von Buren and his 126 Nazis whisked away for us. Most of the Rocketeers were dedicated German Nazis whisked out of Europe to continue the work for us here in the United States. At the time of their surrender, they were working on a rocket to deliver warheads to New York City, as they had done to London with the V-2. Under Operation Paperclip, these war criminals were slipped away to the United States, kept under wraps, and referred to themselves as POPs, Prisoners of Peace, at Fort Bliss, Texas.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 11th in 1972, a group of Chicano teachers, students, and community activists in Seattle, Washington, entered the abandoned Beacon Hill High School building and announced their intention to stay until the city met their demands. The group peacefully occupied the school for 3 months in the middle of winter before they were finally granted the space to establish a Chicano community center. This action was triggered after the city abruptly cut funding for an adult basic education and ESL program at the local community college, leaving its students ripped of their educational resources. The community center, El Centro de la Raza, became one of the most effective Latino civil rights organizations in America. Now that's community empowerment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, for October 11th, 1987, up to 750,000 gays, lesbians, and bisexuals and their supporters marched for civil rights in Washington. This is the second lesbian and gay march, and again generally goes underreported by the press. Now each year at this time it is celebrated as the National Coming Out Day. This week in Radical History for October 12th, 1492 in the New World, Columbus. Invader, slaver, thief, murderer, liar, madman, he and his crew signals the start of the European invasion of the Americas. "We could subjugate them all," unquote. Columbus wrote at the start of the European destruction of the American continent, "There is no holiday for the tribes of the Arawaks, who lived there at the time that Columbus discovered them. In the next 25 years, all 50,000 natives had died or been shipped away as slaves." Also on October 10, 1896, Johann Most, German-American anarchist, and Emma Goldman's former mentor, denounces her at the time of the event of the New York where she was soliciting funds for the commemoration of the execution of the Haymarket Martyrs. Emma would seek him out, find him on stage, and punch him in the face.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 12th in 1898, the Verdun Massacre occurred when a labor conflict between the Chicago Verdun Coal Company and their unionized miners in St. Louis turned violent. The tension began after the Verdun Company backed down on their promise to enforce an 8-hour workday and a pay increase. The company then brought in hundreds of non-unionized black laborers from Alabama and locked the union workers out of the mines. As a train carrying the strike breakers arrived, shots were fired between the strikers and the armed guards, resulting in the death of many union members and a few guards. The Verdun Company then left the black laborers stranded in St. Louis with no money or shelter and gave in to the mining union's terms. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. Thank you for tuning in, whether you're listening on the radio, streaming on your computer, or checking us out on the archive. We appreciate your joining us. This Week in Palestine features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, which is so lacking in the mainstream media, but so needed to counter the Israeli narrative that is often based on factual inaccuracies, myths, and distortions. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. Despenu Moussouris is our producer, and I am your host, John Roberts. We begin with news out of Palestine. Quoting from the New York Times, demonstrating a new level of tension with Israel, President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority declared on Wednesday that his people were no longer bound by mutual agreements with Israel, including the Oslo Peace Accords, which created the foundation for the Middle East peace process. In his annual General Assembly speech, Mr. Abbas accused Israel of having systematically violated these pacts, which date back two decades and outline security, economic, and other arrangements in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel during and after the 1967 war. The agreements formed the basis for governing much of daily life in the occupied West Bank, where the Palestinian Authority is based. End of quote from the New York Times. The Oslo Accords were a disaster for the Palestinians from the beginning. Israel was never really willing to set any boundaries delineating Israeli and Palestinian land. And so from the outset, Israel continued to do what its intentions were from the beginning. They continued to take Palestinian land inside the international green line. There are now about 650,000 Jewish settlers within the West Bank. Palestinian autonomy, promised but never delivered, has become a cruel joke. The Palestinian Authority has become a wing of the Israeli security apparatus. Finally, Abbas has blown the whistle, but it is too late for the two-state solution that was the goal of the accords. In an interview published by the Institute for Middle East Understanding, Ramallah-based attorney Diana Boutu analyzes what may lie ahead for the Palestinians without the structure of the Oslo Accords. When asked about an assessment of the Oslo Accords for Palestinians, Ms. Boutu responded, quote, "The U.S.-sponsored Oslo Accords have been an unmitigated disaster for Palestinians. Instead of leading to Palestinian freedom, the Oslo process entrenched Palestinian dependence on Israel economically, while giving Israel cover to deepen its occupation and settlement enterprise without suffering international censure for its violations of international law and human rights abuses. Since the signing of the first of the Oslo Accords in 1993, the number of Israeli settlers living illegally on occupied Palestinian land has nearly tripled to 650,000, and the occupied territories have been systematically carved up into easily controlled Bantustans. Oslo has entrenched a system of apartheid whereby Palestinian and Israelis are subjected to two different and unequal systems of laws living on the same territory. Due to the Oslo Accords, Palestinians and their economy have remained hostage to Israel. The Paris Protocol, the framework that governs economic relations between Israel and the PA, was supposed to be temporary like the rest of the Oslo Accords, but had the effects of making permanent Israel's domination of the Palestinian economy through provisions like the stipulation that Israel collects tax revenues on behalf of the PA. In this light, it is not surprising that support for Oslo has steadily declined over the years. When asked what would happen if the Palestinian Authority is dissolved and Oslo is annulled, Ms. Boutu responded, "The PA will not be dissolved anytime soon. It is in the interests of both Israel and the international community for the PA to remain intact, and many Palestinians rely on it financially. The PA provides the international community with the ability to channel funds directly to select Palestinians while allowing Israel to subcontract enforcement of the occupation, as well as responsibility for the well-being of the Palestinian population, which legally Israel remains responsible for as the occupying power. Israel also maintains leverage over Palestinians in the occupied territories by controlling the transfer of tax money that the PA relies upon." In other words, the PA serves to keep Palestinians subservient to the demands of Israel and the donor community. As a result, Israel and the international community, including the U.S., will continue to keep the PA afloat, at least in the near term. When asked what were the alternatives to the Oslo negotiation model, Diana Boutu replied, "For Palestinians, the alternative to the failed Oslo negotiations model is a broad-based, nonviolent, popular struggle for equal rights featuring three main components. The first is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS movement, which has broad support in Palestine and has made significant progress in countries around the world in the decades since it began, including the U.S. Inspired by the U.S. civil rights movement and the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, the BDS aims to realize Palestinian freedom and rights using nonviolent means, including economic pressure. The second component is to press for Israel to be held accountable for its violations of international law and human rights abuses in international forums, like the International Criminal Court. The third component is popular unarmed resistance, as practiced regularly in a number of West Bank towns in recent years. Combined, these three forms of action stand a far better chance of leading to Palestinian freedom than continuing to engage in bilateral or even multilateral negotiations towards a two-state solution that died years ago, and that was never really desirable from the point of view of realizing Palestinian rights to begin with. Even if a Palestinian state were to be created in the occupied territories, Palestinian citizens of Israel, about 20% of the Israeli population, would remain second-class citizens in their own homeland while a majority of Palestinian refugees would be denied their internationally recognized legal right to return to the lands they were expelled from during Israel's creation of its state. In short, the two-state solution was never really a solution at all for most Palestinians. Attorney Diana Bucciu was then asked, "What do you think the U.S. should do?" And she replied, "The U.S. should begin by conditioning the billions of dollars in military aid that is sent annually to Israel on respect for U.S. and international law, both of which Israel routinely flouts. If Israel refuses, the U.S. should cut off aid. By continuing to grant Israel special status and massive unconditional support, the U.S. encourages Israeli leaders in their destructive behavior, which no fewer than three Israeli prime ministers warned would turn Israel into an apartheid state, and sends the message to Palestinians and people around the world that the U.S. supports Israel's brutal, discriminatory treatment of Palestinians. The U.S. should also abandon the delusional notion that a people living under the military rule of a much stronger foreign power can and should negotiate their freedom with their occupier. Instead, the U.S. should press for the international community to finally begin to hold Israel accountable for its actions, and it should support rather than obstruct Palestinian efforts to achieve their freedom peacefully using BDS, the International Criminal Court, and other means." That was an interview of Palestinian attorney Diana Bucciu, conducted by the Institute for Middle East Understanding in the wake of Mahmoud Abbas's declaring before the UN General Assembly that Palestine would no longer honor the Oslo Accords. Moving on from the news, this morning we want to take a look at a Palestinian organization that does an amazing job of supporting the production of Palestinian products and marketing them to the world in the face of enormous Israeli restrictions and rigorous conditions that must be adhered to. A year ago, I interviewed Mohammed Hamada, who heads the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committee, PARC. PARC's success story, despite overwhelming obstacles created by the occupying power Israel, bears repeating, and therefore we went into our archive to present once again the PARC story. Here is my interview with Mohammed Hamadat. Our feature presentation this morning is an interview with Mohammed Hamadat, one of the founders and driving forces behind the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees, known by the acronym PARC, P-A-R-C. I sat down with Mohammed in Cambridge as he came through town on a whirlwind tour of the fair trade cooperatives who market much of his organization's produce in this country. PARC emerged from the huge voluntary movement that prevailed and characterized the scene in the Palestinian territories in the late 1970s and early 1980s. It was formed by a group of agronomists, agricultural engineers, pioneer farmers, and veterinarian doctors who were active in the voluntary movement and who were convinced that forming specialized agricultural voluntary groups would serve the farmers, the Palestinian agricultural sector, and the national goal of protecting the land in a better way. PARC was founded in 1983 in response to the lack of agricultural extension services for Palestinian farmers. This sector was intentionally ignored by the so-called Israeli Civil Administration Agricultural Department, hoping that Palestinian farmers would desert their land and thus make it an easy target for land confiscation. Therefore, PARC at that time was founded to achieve two main objectives. One, to protect Palestinian land from confiscation by the Israeli occupation. The fact that since it occupied the Palestinian territories in 1967, Israel has applied a systematic policy of confiscation of Palestinians' land in order to build Israeli Jewish settlements to the detriment of Palestinian land ownership. Exploiting the Ottoman law, Israeli occupation forces used to confiscate any Palestinian land that had not been utilized for three consecutive years. To provide Palestinian farmers who were intentionally ignored by the so-called Israeli Civil Administration, Agricultural Department, with the agricultural extension needed for improving the Palestinian agricultural sector. The Palestinian agricultural sector now found itself confronted with a very difficult challenge and competition with the Israeli agricultural sector, which is heavily subsidized and supported by very developed and extensive organized extension, research, and financial institutions. The restrictions on the transportation of Palestinian produce, people, and flooding of Israeli agricultural produce in Palestinian territories rendered the Palestinian competition very difficult. Now, with the advent of the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees, the Palestinians have a strong organization to help organize and support the production and export of their agricultural products. PARC has become the leading Palestinian NGO working in the field of rural development, environmental protection, and women empowerment. It offers technical assistance and support along with extension services to individuals and organizations working cooperatively. With that for an introduction, here is my interview with Mohammed Hamadat of the Palestine Agricultural Relief Committees. So, Mohammed, tell us about PARC, what it, exactly it does, what it is, what your role in it is, and perhaps what role it plays in the economy, how it, what kind of impact it makes on the economy.
Yeah. First of all, I would like to thank you for inviting me for this interview. And you pronounced my name is Mohammed Hamidat. I'm from PARC Palestine. And PARC means Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees. These are the abbreviations. And this is a non-governmental organization established by a group of agronomist volunteers in 1983. In that time, the agricultural sector in Palestine, there is no Palestinian authority, there is no Ministry of Agriculture to take care with the agricultural sector. So a group of agronomists start voluntary work to give farmers training and extension and to help them how to take care with their products. And from that time, PARC start the activities and start get small funds from international organizations whom believe with the work of these volunteers and start with rural development, not only agriculture, start with rural development for in the rural areas in Palestine. And nowadays, PARC is most of the biggest organization in Palestine, work in many sections and have many departments, and each department is responsible to help in sub-individual section to help the farmers or the women's society or women clubs or youth or farmer cooperatives and also marketing for sure. As I told, PARC nowadays have many departments, like women department to there are women, we call it women clubs or women cooperatives distributed in the rural area, in the villages. And in these cooperatives or clubs, a woman can get training, extension about their rights and how to improve their situation and how to be, to play a big, a good role in the Palestinian society, and also get training and extension about in some projects like food processing, home gardening, and homemade things like textile or broidery or something like this, mm-hmm. to enable them to maybe some of them open their own project and can get income from these projects.
So you help them with a startup if they have
with training, extension, mm-hmm. and sometimes we have a project department. Mm-hmm. In the project departments, if there is available any project, so these projects goes to maybe women clubs or cooperatives, farmer cooperatives, to help.
Nice.
So there are another department which called project departments, which give this department get make fundraising and get fund from outside, like EU or like states, and in these projects, it is directed projects. Some of these projects goes to home gardening or to food processing. Some of these projects goes to land reclamation or plantation, and some of these projects goes to water to collect and harvest water in reservoir, underground reservoir, in the field or near the houses for drinking and domestic water. Some projects directed to farmer cooperatives to give them training and extension on quality, also to support them with some tools or some small devices to improve the quality and to of their product for sure. So this is the project department. Mm-hmm. So we have also a youth department. In the youth department, there are, in most of the villages, there are youth clubs, so they can meet and they can get also training and extension about political issues, economical issues, and they can take training on computer in some activities, mm-hmm. you see, and they take some lectures in many subjects.
So, well, here in this country, you're perhaps best known for the olive oil.
Yeah.
How does that work? How do local farmers relate to you in terms of their olives, the production, the bottling, the export? How is that organized?
Yeah. Before answering this question, I'm going to the most important department also in part, mm-hmm. which is Fair Trade Department.
Fair Trade.
Yeah, so the Fair Trade Department where I'm working, mm-hmm. as a quality control manager. So in the Fair Trade Department, the output of the products from the women clubs, from the farmer cooperatives, whom producing foodstuffs or whom producing agricultural products. So the Fair Trade Department is responsible for quality control and for marketing locally and internationally these products. So to produce these products according to the Palestinian and international standards to be marketable internationally, mm-hmm. and locally. So for olive oil, for example, which is exported here to states and distributed by Equal Exchange Organization, which is a fair trade organization here. In Palestine, or in PARC, in the Fair Trade Department, we believe that solidarity is important, but we believe that also the solidarity need to be supported by quality also.
Yes.
So we focus on quality. We focus a lot on quality, and we get a lot of certificates of mm-hmm. olive oil. We have Palestinian Standard Institute certificate, which is local certificate from Palestinian Standard Institute for quality. And we have ISO 22000 certificate, which is ISO system combined with HACCP system. HACCP, which is, we call it in small words, we call it food safety system.
Mm-hmm.
So we have international food safety system, and we accredited from outside.
I see.
And we audited, accredited and audited from outside. And we have also a FLO certificate, Fair Trade Labeling Organization certificate. We have organic certificate also.
Yes.
Yeah. So we focus on these certificates to help marketing and to support the solidarity about marketing olive oil internationally. About the quality system, about the relation with the farmer cooperatives, we have in Park more than 35 to 40 farmer cooperatives distributed from south to north. And these cooperatives are independent. They have their own board, and they have election and everything, and they produce the olive oil for their members, from their members. And in Park, our mission is to encourage these farmers to collaborate in a cooperatives and to be independent. And we need to build sustainable bodies like these cooperatives to be independent, so they can sell to Park or they can sell to any trader. They can sell to any trader.
Okay, so some of them actually sell to you. That is, one of the cooperatives will sell you a certain amount of oil, and that's the oil that you then bottle and sell internationally.
Yeah, our mission is to train them firstly to be independent and to be and to have ability to market their oil for PAC or for any other thing.
But when they market, it's mostly locally?
Yeah, this is the first thing. The cooperatives mostly export.
Oh, they export also.
Yeah, because cooperatives represent maybe a portion of the of the old Palestinian farmers.
I see. So they're exporting also. So they're meeting all the international standards and everything else. I see. And you're helping them do that.
This exactly, because these cooperatives produce olive oil in high quality standards.
Yes.
So, in Park, we support these cooperatives through the project department. We support them with pruning tools, with stainless steel tanks, with plastic boxes to collect the fruit, and support some of the cooperatives have own mills. So we support them through the project department to rehabilitate these mills to be to produce high quality oil also. So after that, we support them and train them also with small mini labs, laboratory, to analyze the main analysis like acidity and peroxide, and we train two or three members from each cooperative how to analyze it.
I see.
So they have ability.
They're doing their own inspections.
Yeah.
They
do their own inspection. They grade their oils. This tank is virgin. This tank is extra virgin. So they know. When we have orders in Park, we go to these cooperatives. Our technician goes to these cooperatives and take samples from each tank, analyze all the tanks, and after that, go to the Excel sheet and see which is rejected, which is acceptable from these tanks. And then send our truck to pump the oil with mobile tanks, with our mobile tanks, to the filling station in Aram near Ramallah. We have full automatic bottling line. We invest in a full automatic bottling line also to have very nice and very quality-wise and very nice shape of bottle to be marketable. And we do a further analysis for the quality assurance that the sample is look like the same of the oil we received. And also during processing, during filling, we filtrate the oil to remove all the sediments firstly. And we have traceability system also. If you catch any bottle from our oil here in state, you can give me the lot number, which is written on the bottle. I can tell you this oil from which cooperative, at what time we receive it, at what time we filtrate it, at what time we fill it in the bottles, and all these
things. All traceable.
So we trace it from the cooperative to until the shelf in the market. So this is in brief about the quality system for olive oil. And our olive oil is marketed to states, to Japan, to Canada, to most of European countries like Italy, Belgium, France. We export it.
Wonderful.
And New Zealand and Sweden.
When we were there, we went to visit the cooperative that did the couscous down near Jericho. Tell us about the women. We saw a lot of women working there. They, I think they were working on couscous. I think some women were sewing. But we saw a lot of very, very busy women working there.
Olive oil is one of our major products, which is exported. But it is not the only.
Right.
We have couscous, handmade couscous by women cooperative in Jericho. We have, I will speak it later about it. We have dates also.
Dates, yes.
Yeah, dates, majul dates. We have almond. We have za'atar, which is spiced.
Oh, the za'atar is wonderful.
Yes, za'atar, yeah. And we have also some products marketed locally, like yogurt, honey, pickings, and and we have also olive oil soap, which is exported also outside. For couscous, or regarding couscous, we have a woman cooperative in Jericho, around 30-35 women working all over the year in this couscous cooperative where you was being.
Yeah.
And this project, firstly designed for Gaza in Park, before 2007, it is designed for Gaza to help the women in the refugee camps in Gaza to create job for them.
Yes.
But about after the problems in Gaza and the closure of Gaza, our work stopped over there. We cannot release any quantity of couscous from Gaza, and we stay around 6 or 8 months without production. There is a shortage in the international market because they know our couscous and they like it. And they're asking us, where is the couscous? And how we should wait till Gaza opened. We wait 6 or 8 months and Gaza didn't open. So we take a decision in part to train another group of women in Jericho. Jericho, because it's very close to our headquarters in Ramallah, this is the first thing. The other thing is the nature of Jericho, which is very hot. So we have sun dryers over there, and it's good for couscous production because we have sun dryers there. Mm-hmm. So we start training the women and to build the quality manual for them. Mm-hmm. And now we have a very, very good quality manual, and the couscous produced is very is high quality couscous. In this project also, we arrange with farmer cooperative in Jenin to plant the wheat for the couscous. Mm-hmm. Because couscous is 100% wheat. Nothing. The ingredient is 100% wheat. So the farmer cooperative in Jenin plant the wheat, and we check the quality of the wheat, then grind it and send it to the woman cooperative in Jericho to have complete cycle Palestinian products. So it's a job creation and marketing for also Palestinian agricultural products, which is wheat. In Jericho, I told you they have we have around 35 women working all over the year, and they get a good income. And most of these women from refugee camps near Jericho and from Jericho city also, from Ain Sultan refugee camp, from Aqba Jabir refugee camp, and from Jericho city itself also.
I see.
So, and they are happy. The women are happy. Maybe you see them because they are busy and they are work, and they get a good income from this project. So it's a job creation for them. And also couscous itself, it's a cultural product. So when we export couscous to the international market, we feel that we share the people outside with our cultural food.
Yes.
So like olive oil and za'atar also. Yes. It's our traditional breakfast. So in the morning, our traditional breakfast, cup of tea with olive oil and za'atar. So this is cultural issue.
Yes.
So also couscous is a cultural cook, or cultural food in Palestine.
Now tell me, what it's like to try to move the products through throughout the West Bank with the checkpoints and the military. Are there a lot of problems there? Are you able to really move things through pretty well?
You know, the situation in Palestine, it's like foggy. Well, it depends on the situation. Sometimes you cannot move 1 or 2 kilometers. Sometimes you can move. So, or sometimes you are on the road and the checkpoint stop you, and maybe you stay a few hours, maybe ask you to return back. So the situation, it is, there are a lot of obstacles. This is internally. And but we in PARC as employees, and also the cooperative, the farmer cooperatives, found all the time, try to find a solution. If this road is closed, try to go the mountain roads and to reach our destination. So it's a little bit difficult,
challenging. And
it is challenging us to take round roads, and sometimes it's dangerous.
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes it's dangerous. This is internally, and for exporting, for exportation, after the wall built, we face a big problem in exportation. Why? Because the exportation fees is doubled, completely doubled.
Doubled since the building of the wall?
More than doubled. Yeah. I will tell you how. Before, I'm with PARC since 17 years, so I know that before and after. So before, the container came to our warehouse, and we fill the products inside the container completely. Now, it is not allowable for the container to come to our warehouse to be filled. We should put the products in a pallet, and the pallet should be not high. The height of the pallet should be not exceed 160 centimeter, while the container height is 230 centimeter. So we lose half of the container. This is because of security reasons. So to be scanned in the machines. And
so this is the Israeli
New regulation.
Yes.
Yeah. So so the pallet is 160 centimeter. So we lose half of the container, which means that we pay double for the shipping, and we pay double for the insurance of the shipping.
Oh, yes.
So the cost, the fees, doubled. This is one thing. Another thing, we should bring a Palestinian truck from our warehouse, which is a few kilometers to Betunia checkpoint. So a Palestinian truck to put the product on the checkpoint near Ramallah. And because of the traffic, because a lot of trucks, so we ask the driver to come one night before, and we load the products, and we pay over for the truck driver to sleep in his truck in order to be in early morning on the checkpoint.
I see.
You see? And after that, this is a few kilometers just. After that, the pallets should be downloaded, and we should pay for the forklift who download on the checkpoint, and we should pay for land.
Okay, so you're unloading at the checkpoint. You have to unload the truck at the checkpoint.
You unload the truck on the ground. So we pay for the forklift, and we pay for the land also.
Now, you have to fill the truck up then again to proceed beyond the checkpoint.
And after checkpoint, the product should be checked, and we pay the fees for checking also.
Right.
After that, we should bring another Israeli truck, Israeli plate truck.
I see.
And the forklift also upload the products again, and we pay
right,
also for
that.
It.
Now these are checkpoints that are when the produce is going into Israel.
Yeah. It is
okay.
On the wall. It is
on the wall. So you're bringing it to the wall, unloading it into another truck with Israeli with the yellow plates, right?
Yeah.
I see, yeah.
And then it goes to the seaport, in the seaport also, download it and upload it in the container.
I see.
So we pay for all these steps also. It's over cost.
Yeah. Now, do you...
And inequality issues also, when the truck leave our warehouse, we didn't have any quality. We didn't have any control on the product. If it is damaged, sometimes our partners here or outside. Oh, we have pallets destroyed. We have oil leakage. We have some cartons turned upside. and we do not, because we lose the control of, on the product.
Once it goes beyond the wall.
Yeah.
Do you? We see sometimes that do you sell to Israel? Do you sell produce? Do you sell any of these goods to Israel?
It is a little bit difficult to sell to Israel because they put a lot of regulations and to get a lot of permissions from Minister of Agriculture, Minister of Health, but few products can enter.
Yeah. Because we had heard sometimes that Israelis will purchase Palestinian goods and then put their own brand on it and say, you know, produced in Israel or something. And take the identity away from where the product was really produced. Do you run into that problem at all?
I don't know about this, but one year we have a lot of excess oil.
Mm-hmm.
We produce a lot. I don't know, 2008 or 2000. Yeah. I think so. Something like this. We have a lot of excess olive oil, so the price goes down, and traders from inside Israel. Some traders came and bought a lot of quantity of olive oil and exported outside.
Yeah.
Maybe they exported under their
under
name.
Their own label, yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. And now what are you doing on this trip? What are you doing here in the United States?
I'm here in a health vacation. Mm-hmm. I was been in. I'm here in States since November 3rd. I came to Houston. I had there in Houston, in Texas Orthopedic Hospital, I had total knee replacement.
Knee replacement?
Yeah, in my knee, I had total knee replacement, complex knee.
Yeah.
And I finished the physical therapy, and our friends here in Equal Exchange, whom imported our olive oil from Palestine,
mm-hmm.
invited me to meet the people and to see the people here and to see the organization and how our olive oil marketed here.
Oh, wonderful. So is this the first time you've been here to do that?
This is the first time for me in States.
Uh-huh.
This is my first visit to States.
Well, that's wonderful. It's certainly wonderful for us to make that connection, and I'm sure for the cooperative, you know, it's important. We've had Palestinian olive oil here for years through Tanya Maxwell and her group, and we and a lot of our friends buy it by the case. It's wonderful.
I see the people here who marketing Palestinian olive oil do a good voluntary job. Today I was being in West Massachusetts, and I see how they market the olive oil. There is a bazaar and a church, and how they sell the fair trade products, the chocolate and other things, and our olive oil for sure I see. And these people doing all this things voluntary, so they did a great job.
Yeah. Great job.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very informative. I'm so glad to see you because we had such a wonderful visit at Park in Jericho when we were there, and we love the olive oil.
Yeah.
And what we often do is sometimes here when you go to someone's house for dinner. People will bring a bottle of wine for the dinner. We often bring a bottle of Palestinian olive oil to give to the host.
Yeah, it's a great thing where olive oil has a lot of health benefits.
Yes,
it's anti-carcinogenic, anti-heart disease, and have a lot of health benefits.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, Mohammed Himadak, thank you very much. And best wishes for the rest of your trip and for healing that knee.
Yeah, thank you very much. I will be back to tomorrow morning. I will be back to Houston.
Yes.
To be checked up from my doctor, mm-hmm. final checkup, and then December 10th,
you're going home?
Tuesday, my flight to Amman.
So you've been
and then to Palestine.
So you've been gone since November 3rd, and you're not going to get back till December 11th or 12th or so.
I will be in Palestine maybe December 13th.
December 13 or 14 something.
It's not allowed. It's not allowable for us to fly directly to to Tel Aviv and then to Palestine. We fly to Amman and from Amman pass the bridge to Jericho and to Palestine.
Oh, wonderful, Muhammad. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your. Thank you to you.
That was my interview with Mohammed Hamadat, who heads the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Society, PARC. Before leaving this morning, we must give a salute to the United Nations, which, despite objections from the U.S. and Israel, this past week raised the Palestinian flag to stand among all the other nations which comprise the U.N. A symbolic victory for Palestine, but a victory nonetheless. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 723 of Unwelcome Guests, a U.S. deep state event, the deep implications of the 9/11 money trail. I'm Robin Upton, and we have two pieces for you this week. First one is a recent analysis of the 9/11 money trail by James Corbett. Our focus this week will be 9/11, but not as we've looked at it before. We have had literally dozens of shows on 9/11, so if you're new to the program, you may wish to look at our 9/11 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/911. They've looked at operational factors. We're going to be looking more at the people and their hidden connections to the events, to the technologies, and especially to the money. As I was researching this program, I was updating WikiSpooks, trying to get a handle on the different personalities involved. Let me give you a brain teaser before we get started with James Corbett. I wonder why, in spite of an absolute mound of evidence, Ernest Weltke, head of the Bundesbank, said after 9/11, what we have found makes us sure that people connected to the terrorists must have been trying to profit from this tragedy. So about as definitive as you can get there, and backed up by a lot of other people, a lot of other bankers, researchers, options traders, government officials. There was quite clearly a mound of evidence of 9/11 insider trading of two main varieties. There were people who were taking put options on United Airlines, on the insurers, on the World Trade Center tenants, people who could say, well, they're
stock is going to be going down, and the other half, call options, people who are betting on a price increase on Raytheon, arms manufacturers, people selling airport security could see there was going to be a booming market ahead. So two distinct categories of insider trading going on. Given that there was a mound of evidence and that the SEC concluded their investigation saying, well, nobody with conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda was involved in this insider trading, so we're not going to say any more about it. If that was their foregone conclusion, I wonder why they had such an extensive investigation. Now, you might say, well, it was for show, it looked good. They didn't take that approach with the 9/11 Commission. That was sort of rather starved of funding. So why the large-scale SEC investigation in collaboration with the FBI, the Treasury Department, and the Department of Justice? I shall leave that question hanging. Now let's proceed with the following recent production by James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
Al-Qaeda, 9/11 hijackers.
Jihadist. Terrorist organizations.
Terror attack.
Bin Laden.
September 11th.
Terrorist.
The self-confessed mastermind.
Osama bin Laden. The leader of Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda.
Terrible new terrorist organization.
September 11th.
Our enemy is a radical network of terrorists and every government that supports them.
Forget for one moment everything you've been told about September 11th, 2001. Instead, let's ask ourselves one question. What was 9/11? A terrorist atrocity? An attack on America? The first salvo in a new war? A day that changed everything? The question may seem simple, but how we answer it is of vital importance. It determines how we proceed with our investigation of that day. And once you strip away the emotional rhetoric and the fear-inducing imagery, we're left with the simple truth. 9/11 was a crime. And as with any crime, there is one overriding imperative that detectives must follow to identify the perpetrators. Follow the money. This is an investigation of the 9/11 money trail. In 1998, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey agreed to privatize the World Trade Center, the complex of office towers in Lower Manhattan that they had owned and operated since their construction in 1973. In April 2001, an agreement was reached with a consortium of investors led by Silverstein Properties, and on July 24, 2001, Larry Silverstein, who already owned World Trade Center Building 7, signed a 99-year lease for the Twin Towers and Buildings 4 and 5. The lease was for $3.2 billion and was financed by a bridge loan from GMAC, the commercial mortgage arm of General Motors, as well as $111 million from Lloyd Goldman and Joseph Kerr, individual real estate investors. Silverstein Properties only put down $14 million of its own money. The deal was unusual in a variety of ways. Although the Port Authority carried only $1.5 billion of insurance coverage on the WTC complex, which earlier that year had been valued at $1.2 billion, Silverstein had insisted on doubling that amount, insuring the buildings for $3.55 billion. Silverstein's insurance broker struggled to put that much coverage in place, and ultimately had to split it among 25 dealers. The negotiations were so involved that only temporary contracts were in place for the insurance at the time the lease was signed, and by September the contracts were still being finalized. Silverstein's group was also explicitly given the right to rebuild the structures if they were destroyed, and even to expand the amount of retail space on the site if rebuilding did take place. Within hours of the destruction of the Twin Towers on September 11th, Silverstein was on the phone to his lawyers, trying to determine if his insurance policies could construe the attacks as two separate insurable incidents rather than one. Silverstein spent years in the courts attempting to win $7.1 billion from his $3.55 billion insurance policy, and in 2007 walked away with $4.55 billion, the largest single insurance settlement ever. As soon as the deal was announced, Silverstein sued United and American Airlines for a further $3.5 billion for their negligence in the 9/11 attacks. A claim that was struck down by the courts but is still on appeal. Perhaps even more outrageously, in a secret deal in 2003, the Port Authority agreed to pay back 80% of their initial equity in the lease, but allowed the Silverstein Group to maintain control of the site. The deal gave Silverstein, Goldman, and Kerr $98 million of the $125 million they put down on the lease, and a further $130 million in insurance proceeds that were earmarked for the site's rebuilding. In the end, Silverstein profited from the 9/11 attacks to the tune of $4.5 billion and counting. But that's the 9/11 insurance heist you saw. There was a much deeper, more complex, and well-hidden heist that was taking place behind closed doors on September 11, 2001, deep in the heart of the World Trade Center itself. Marsh & McLennan is a diversified risk, insurance, and professional services firm with over $13 billion in annual revenue and 57,000 employees. In September of 2001, 2,000 of those employees worked in Marsh's offices in the World Trade Center. Marsh occupied floors 93 to 100 of the North Tower, the exact area of the impact and explosion. In the year prior to 9/11, Marsh had contracted with Silverstream Software to create an electronic connection between Marsh and its clients for the purpose of creating paperless transactions. Silverstream had already built internet-based transactional and trading platforms for Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, Alex Brown, Morgan Stanley, and other financial services firms that were later involved in 9/11, but this new project was unlike anything that had been attempted before. Richard Andrew Grove, the salesperson who handled the Marsh & McLennan project for Silverstream, explains.
In 2000, Silverstream was contracted by Marsh to provide a technological solution beyond what we had done for any of the above-named companies insofar as it would be used to electronically connect Marsh to its major business partners via internet portals for the purpose of creating paperless transactions and expediting revenue and renewal cycles, and built from the ground up at the client's site. Silverstream provided a specific type of connectivity that was used to link AIG and Marsh & McLennan, the first two commercial companies on the planet to employ this specific type of transaction. And in fact, Marsh was presented with something called the Accord Award, A-C-O-R-D, in the summer of 2001 for being the first commercial corporation to do so. And what you should take away from that is this. It means that no other companies were doing this type of transaction, so the question in your mind should be, what then were Marsh and AIG doing, and why did they need to leverage technologies that no other commercial entity on the face of the earth needed to conduct business? The contract, Silverstream then stationed approximately 30 to 40 developers at Marsh, and this team was led by 2 to 3 managers with whom I liaised to ensure delivery of the solution that was promised. The development team worked regularly into the night, if not all night, and sometimes worked 7 days a week in order to adhere to Marsh's indicated pre-September 11th deadline. Now, while I was...
But it was not long before severe irregularities in the billing of the account for this project led Richard Grove into the heart of a deeper mystery about the software and about the work that he was engaged in.
This fiscal anomalies with respect to the Marsh.com project when I was in a meeting on the 98th floor in October of 2000 with a gentleman named Gary Lasko. Gary was Marsh's North American Chief Information Officer, and that particular afternoon a colleague and I helped him identify about $10 million in suspicious purchase orders after I had recognized that certain vendors were deceiving Marsh and specifically appeared to be selling Marsh large quantities of hardware that were not necessary, as this was later confirmed by Gary. In the spring of 2000, I brought my concerns up to executives inside of Silverstream, and I was urged to keep quiet and mind my own business. I went to an executive inside of Marsh, and he advised me to do likewise. But then, I mentioned it to a few executives at Marsh who I could trust, like Gary Lasko and Catherine Lee, Ken Rice, Richard Bruhart, and John Oldtoffer, people who became likewise concerned that something untoward was going on. The concerned colleagues I just mentioned were murdered on September 11th, and the executives who expressed dismay at my concerns are alive and free today because of it. I feel it's no coincidence as the Marsh executive who urged me to drop my line of inquiry made sure that his personnel, who I just mentioned, were in the office bright and early for a global conference call before the staff meeting upon which I was to intrude. A conference call which I was informed this executive in question conducted, but attended from the safety of his Upper West Side apartment. Although in getting...
The global conference call with Marsh's IT staff on the morning of 9/11, a meeting that included the staff who were investigating the suspicious billing on the Silverstream deal, was confirmed in a 2006 interview with Marsh's then-chief information officer, Ellen Clark. Richard Grove had been asked to attend the meeting, but was stuck in traffic on the way to the towers when the attack began. His friends at Marsh were not so lucky. 294 Marsh employees, including all of the participants in the conference call in the North Tower, died that morning. Meanwhile, the Marsh executive who had scheduled the meeting, the same one who had asked Grove to drop the issue of the billing anomalies, was safe in his apartment, attending the meeting via telephone. So what was the Marsh.com project really about? Why was it so important for it to be finished before September 11th? And what kind of transactions did it enable? More importantly, what information was lost when the data center on the 95th floor of the North Tower suffered a direct hit on 9/11 and the buildings were demolished? A partial answer comes from reports that emerged in late 2001 that a German firm, Convar, had been hired to reconstruct financial data from the hard disks recovered at Ground Zero. The firm talks about this work in its promotional videos.
September the 11th, 2001. The whole world is in shock following the attacks on the World Trade Center. Convar has some solutions to offer. Data stored on countless hard drives retrieved from the collapsed towers was believed to have been lost, but Convar specialists can render irreplaceable information readable again at Europe's only high-security data recovery center. Burnt, crushed, or dirty storage media are ready to relinquish their secrets by the time we finish with them.
More details about the work comes from an IDG news service story posted to CNN.com in December 2001. Under the headline, "Computer disk drives from WTC could yield clues," the article notes, "An unexplained surge in transactions was recorded prior to the attacks, leading to speculation that someone might have profited from previous knowledge of the terrorist plot by moving sums of money. But because the facilities of many financial companies processing the transactions were housed in New York's World Trade Center, destroyed in the blasts, it has, until now, been impossible to verify that suspicion." A Reuters article from the same time, later posted to Convar's website, offers revealing glimpses into the investigation's early results. It quotes Peter Herschel, Convar's director at the time. "The suspicion is that inside information about the attacks was used to send financial transaction commands and authorizations in the belief that amid all the chaos the criminals would have, at the very least, a good head start. Of course, it is also possible that there were perfectly legitimate reasons for the unusual rise in business volume. It could turn out that Americans went on an absolute shopping binge on that Tuesday morning. But at this point, there are many transactions that cannot be accounted for. Not only the volume, but the size of the transactions was far higher than usual for a day like that. There is a suspicion that these were possibly planned to take advantage of the chaos." It also quotes Richard Wagner, one of the company's data retrieval experts. "There is a suspicion that some people had advanced knowledge of the approximate time of the plane crashes in order to move out amounts exceeding $100 million. They thought that the records of their transactions could not be traced after the mainframes were destroyed." Was the revolutionary electronic trading link between AIG and Marsh being used to funnel money through the World Trade Center at the time of the attack? Were the attack perpetrators hoping that the destruction of Marsh's data center, on the 95th floor at the dead center of the North Tower explosion, would conceal their economic crime? One piece of corroborating evidence for the idea comes from author and researcher Michael Rupert, who reported in 2004 that immediately before the attacks began, computer systems in Deutsche Bank, one of Silverstream's other E-Link clients, had been taken over from an external location that no one in the office could identify.
Within, I would guess, I'd have to go back and look at the book, but it was no more than a week after the attacks. I was being contacted by a lot of people from inside official sources who were raising a lot of questions. This one particular person was extremely credible. They absolutely convinced me they had been an employee of Deutsche Bank in the Twin Towers. And they told me very clearly that in the moments right before the attacks and during the attack, there was a 40-minute window between the time the first plane struck the World Trade Center and the second plane, that Deutsche Bank's computers in New York City had been taken over, absolutely co-opted and run. There was a massive data purge, a massive data download, and all kinds of stuff was moving. And what this person said very clearly was that no one in the Deutsche Bank offices in the towers at the time had the ability to prevent what was going on from any of their terminals.
Sadly, No answer to the questions raised by these accounts is forthcoming from Convar. After the initial reporting on the investigation, which noted that the company was working with the FBI to recover and analyze the data, Convar now refuses to talk about the information they discovered.
Is it true that large amounts of money were transferred illegally out of the World Trade Center on the morning of 9/11, just before the attacks?
If you would look on the website, I would say yes. Because that was the information from a previous release. If you would ask me today, I would need to tell you that I could not give you any additional information about that. But I'm really sorry.
At the time of 9/11, Marsh's chief of risk management was Paul Bremer, the former managing director of Kissinger and Associates, who went on to oversee the U.S. occupation of Iraq. On the morning of 9/11, he was not in his office at Marsh & McLennan, but at NBC's TV studio, where he was delivering the official story of the attack.
It's Paul Bremer. I want to make sure I'm getting your name right, because right. I'm just meeting you right. just at Thanks. This moment. You're a terrorism expert.
Counterterrorism, I hope.
And can talk to us a little bit about who could... I mean, there are a limited... number yeah. of groups who could be responsible for something of this magnitude.
Yes, this
correct?
Is a very well-planned, very well-coordinated attack, which suggests it's very well organized centrally. And there are only three or four candidates in the world, really, who could have conducted this attack.
Bin Laden comes to mind right away, Mr. Bremer.
Indeed, he certainly does. Bin Laden was involved in the first attack on the World Trade Center, which had as its intention doing exactly what happened here, which was to collapse both towers. He certainly has to be a prime suspect. But there are others in the Middle East, and there are at least two states, Iran and Iraq, which should at least remain on the list of potential suspects.
I don't recall anything like this. Pearl Harbor happened a month before I was born, and I hear my parents talk about that as a seminal event in their lives all the time. I am not aware of anything like this in the United States before. Americans are now, I think it's fair to say, really scared of... Should we be?
This is a day that will change our lives, isn't it?
It is a day that will change our lives. It's a day when the war that the terrorists declared on the United States, and after all, they did declare war on us, has been brought home to the United States in a much more dramatic way than we've seen before. So it will change our lives.
On September 12, 2001, before the dust had even settled on Ground Zero, the Securities and Exchange Commission opened an investigation into a chilling proposition. That an unknown group of traders with advanced knowledge of the 9/11 plot had made millions betting against the companies involved in the attacks.
What many Wall Street analysts believe is that the terrorists made bets that a number of stocks would see their prices fall. They did so by buying what are called puts. If you bet right, the rewards can be huge. The risks are also huge, unless, of course, you know something bad is going to happen to the company you're betting against.
This could very well be insider trading at the worst, most horrific, most evil use you've ever seen in your entire life.
One example, United Airlines. The Thursday before the attack, more than 2,000 contracts betting that the stock would go down were purchased, 90 times more in one day than in 3 weeks. When the markets reopened, United's stock dropped. The price of the contracts soared. And someone may have made a lot of money fast.
$180,000 turns into $2.4 million when that plane hits the World Trade Center.
It's almost the same story with American Airlines.
That's a five-fold increase in the value of what was a $337,000 trade on Monday.
All of a sudden becomes what?
$1.8 million.
And there's much more, including an extraordinarily high number of bets against Morgan Stanley and Marsh & McLennan, two of the World Trade Center's biggest tenants.
Could this be a coincidence?
This would be one of the most extraordinary coincidences in the history of mankind if it was a coincidence.
Although the put options on American and United Airlines are usually cited in reference to the 9/11 insider trading, these trades only represent a fraction of the suspicious trades leading up to the attack. Between August 20th and September 10th, abnormally large spikes in put option activity appeared in trades involving dozens of different companies whose stocks plunged after the attack, including Boeing, Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, Morgan Stanley, Munich Re, and the AXA Group. Traders weren't just betting against the companies whose stocks dove after 9/11, however. There was also a sixfold increase in call options on the stock of defense contractor Raytheon on the day before 9/11. The options allowed the traders to buy Raytheon stock at $25. Within a week of the attack, as the American military began deploying the Raytheon-supplied Tomahawk missiles they would eventually use in the invasion of Afghanistan, the company's share price had shot up 37% to over $34. The SEC weren't the only ones interested in this particular 9/11 money trail either. Investigations into potential insider trading before the attacks were opened by authorities around the globe, from Belgium to France to Germany to Switzerland to Japan. It wasn't long before this global financial manhunt started yielding clues on the trail of the terror traders. On September 17th, Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Martino, addressing Italian CONSOB's own investigation into potential 9/11 trading, said, "I think there are terrorist states and organizations behind speculation on the international markets." By September 24th, the Belgian finance minister was confident enough to publicly announce Belgium's strong suspicions that British markets may have been used for transactions. The president of Germany's central bank was the most adamant. "What we found makes us sure that people connected to the terrorists must have been trying to profit from this tragedy." These foreign leaders were not alone in their conviction that insider trading had taken place. University of Chicago finance professor George Constantinides, Columbia University law professor John Coffey, Duke University law professor James Cox, and other academics, as well as well-known options traders like John Nigerian, all expressed their belief that investors had traded on advance knowledge of the attacks. The scale of the SEC investigation was unprecedented, examining over 9.5 million securities transactions, including stocks and options in 103 different companies trading in 7 markets, 32 exchange-traded funds, and stock indices. The probe drew on the assistance of the legal and compliance staff of the 20 largest trading firms and the regulatory authorities in 10 foreign governments. The commission coordinated its investigation with the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Department of the Treasury. The results of this investigation? "We have not developed any evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks traded on the basis of that information." Although this sounds like the investigation did not find evidence of insider trading, a second look reveals the trick. They are not saying that there was no insider trading, only that there is no evidence that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks participated in such trading. But this begs the question, who had that advanced knowledge, and how did the SEC determine this? The 9/11 Commission report begs the question even more blatantly in their treatment of the anomalous put option activity on United Airlines stock on September 6th. 95% of the puts were placed by a single U.S.-based institutional investor with no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. Again, it is taken as a foregone conclusion that a lack of ties to Al-Qaeda means there could not have been advance knowledge of the attack, even if the evidence shows that insider trading took place. To be sure, insider trading almost certainly did take place in the weeks before 9/11. Although some have used the commission report to conclude that the story was debunked, the intervening years have seen the release of not one, not two, but 3 separate scientific papers concluding with high probability that the anomalous trading was the result of advanced knowledge. In Unusual Option Market Activity in the Terrorist Attacks of September 11th, 2001, University of Chicago professor Alan Potashman concluded, "Examination of the option trading leading up to September 11th reveals that there was an unusually high level of put buying. This finding is consistent with informed investors having traded options in advance of the attacks." In Detecting Abnormal Trading Activities in Option Markets, researchers at the University of Zurich used econometric methods to confirm unusual put option activity on the stocks of key airlines, banks, and reinsurers in the weeks prior to 9/11. And in Was There Abnormal Trading in the S&P 500 Index Options Prior to the September 11th Attacks? A team of researchers concluded that abnormal activity in the S&P Index Options market around the time of the attack is consistent with insiders anticipating the 9/11 attacks. The only question, then, is who was profiting from these trades, and why was no one ever indicted for their participation in them? One lead is pursued by researcher and author Kevin Ryan. In Evidence for Informed Trading on the Attacks of September 11th, he examines an FBI briefing document from 2003 that was declassified in 2009. It describes the results of FBI investigations into 2 of the pre-9/11 trades that the Bureau had identified as suspicious, including the purchase of 56,000 shares of Stratesec in the days prior to 9/11. Stratesec provided security systems to airports, including, ironically, Dulles Airport, as well as the World Trade Center and United Airlines, and saw its share price almost double when the markets reopened on September 17, 2001. The trades traced back to a couple whose names are redacted from the memo, but are easily identifiable from the unredacted information. Mr. and Mrs. Wirt D. Walker III, a distant relative of the Bush family and business partner of Marvin Bush, the president's brother. The document notes that the pair were never even interviewed as part of the investigation because it had revealed no ties to terrorism or other negative information. In addition to begging the question, this characterization is provably false, as Ryan noted in a conversation with financial journalist Lars Schaal.
Wirt Dexter Walker at Stratesec hired several people from a company called the Carlyle Group. And the Carlyle Group had Bin Laden family members as investors. Also, Wirt Walker's fellow director, James Abrahamson, was a close business associate of a man named Mansoor Ijaz, a Pakistani businessman. And Mansoor Ijaz claimed to be able to contact Osama bin Laden on multiple occasions. So there does seem to be some circumstantial evidence indicating that these people were connected to al-Qaeda, at least to the point where we should investigate.
And isn't it true that also some members of the bin Laden family were actually in Washington at a gathering of the Carlyle Group on 9/11?
That's true. The Carlyle Group had a meeting at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington on September 11th, and present there were former President George H.W. Bush, James Baker, and the brother of Osama bin Laden. I believe his name was Salem. I can't recall his exact name. But they were there, investors from the bin Laden family, meeting with Carlyle Group representatives in Washington on September 11th.
Was this why the FBI thought better of questioning Walker over his highly profitable purchase of Stratesec shares right before 9/11? The CIA figures prominently in another line of investigation. One suspicious United Airlines put option purchase that was investigated by the FBI involved a 2,500 contract order for puts in the days before 9/11. Instead of processing the purchase through United Airlines Home Exchange, the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, the order was split into five 500 contract chunks and run through five different options exchanges simultaneously. The unusual order was brokered by Deutsche Bank Alex Brown, a firm that until 1998 was chaired by A.B. Buzzy Krongard, a former consultant to CIA Director James Woolsey, who at the time of 9/11 was himself the executive director of the CIA.
So right after the attacks of 9/11, the name Buzzy Krongard surfaced, and just it was instant research that revealed that Buzzy Krongard had been allegedly recruited by CIA Director George Tenet to become the executive director at CIA, which is the number three position right before the attacks. And Alex Brown was one of the then a subsidiary of Deutsche Bank, was one of the primary instruments or vehicles that handled all of these criminal trades by people who obviously knew that the attacks were going to take place where, how, and involving specific airlines.
Perhaps the most frank admission of insider trading is notable for three things. It was recorded on video. It has never been investigated by any agency or law enforcement official. And it was made by former CIA agent and frequent foreign policy commentator Robert Baer, the real-life inspiration for the character portrayed by George Clooney in Syriana. Talking to citizen journalists after a speaking event in Los Angeles in 2008, Baer was recorded on video making a startling assertion about 9/11 insider trading.
And then the last thing I would leave you with is National Reconnaissance Office was running a drill, a plane crash into their building, and you know they're staffed by DOD and CIA.
I know the guy that went into his broker in San Diego and said, cash me out, it's going down tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
That tells us something.
Wow. What? Yeah,
that tells us something.
Well, his brother worked in the White House.
This truly remarkable statement bears further scrutiny. If Baer is to be believed, a former CIA agent has firsthand knowledge that a White House insider had foreknowledge of the attacks. And to this day, not only has Baer never revealed the identity of this person, but no one has questioned him about his statement or even attempted to pursue this lead. So how is it possible that the SEC overlooked, ignored, or simply chose not to pursue such leads in their investigation? The only possible answer, of course, is that the investigation was deliberately steered away from such persons of interest and any connections that would lead back to foreknowledge by government agencies, federal agents, or their associates in the business world. Unfortunately, we will likely never see documentary evidence of that from the commission itself. One researcher requesting access under the Freedom of Information Act to the documentary evidence that the 9/11 Commission used to conclude that there had been no insider trading received a response that stated that the potentially responsive records have been destroyed. Instead, we are left with sources that refuse to be identified, saying that CBOE records of pre-9/11 options trading have been destroyed, and secondhand accounts of traders who had heard talk of an event in advance of 9/11. In a roundabout way, perhaps the 9/11 Commission reveals more than it lets on when it tries to dismiss key insider trades with the pithy observation that the traders had no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. If those with foreknowledge of the attacks weren't connected to Al-Qaeda, what does that say about the identity of the real 9/11 perpetrators?
ABC News has now learned that the Chicago Board of Options Exchange launched their investigation into the unusual trading last week. That may have given them enough time to stop anyone from profiting from death here in the U.S. It may also give investigators, Peter, a hot trail that might lead them to the terrorists.
Thanks very much. As a reminder of the complications here, though, the Secretary of the Treasury said today of this investigation, you've got to go through 10 veils before you get to the real source.
Yep.
Thanks, Antonio.
PTEC was a Quincy, Massachusetts-based company specializing in enterprise architecture software, a type of powerful computer modeling program that allows large-scale organizations to map their systems and employees and to monitor them in real time. The person running this software has a god's-eye view of processes, personnel, and transactions, and even the ability to use this data to foresee problems before they happen and to intervene to stop them from happening. As a senior consultant working on risk management for J.P. Morgan at the time of 9/11, Indira Singh was looking for exactly this type of software to implement the bank's next-generation risk blueprint. In her search for the ultimate risk management software, PTEC's name was floated as the best candidate for the task.
I had a good life. I did risk at J.P. Morgan Chase. Just to take a break from all the heavy stuff, what I do was to devise a way to monitor everything going on in a very large company to stop big problems from happening. There is that little cloud there and my very bizarre picture of how I think about this problem. I am a person who was merging two disciplines, risk management and something called enterprise architecture, which is fairly esoteric, but at the end of the day, we seek to prevent large problems from happening anywhere in a large global enterprise. At J.P. Morgan, I was working on the next generation risk blueprint, which is all about how to prevent these things from happening. Bad business practice, such as money laundering, rogue trading, and massive computer failures, anything you could imagine would go wrong. I had a lot of leeway consulting as a senior risk architect to think out of the box and actually get my ideas implemented. I was funded out of a strategic fund. I reported to the directors, and I was pretty happy. J.P. Morgan thought very highly of me, and they were thinking of funding, in conjunction with my project in D.C., the next generation risk software. What I needed to do, what I did, was a really smart piece of software. Really, really smart. Its job would be to think about all the information. And this is where you may connect a dot. The job of this software would be to think about all the information that represented what was going on in the enterprise at any given time as bank business was being transacted worldwide. For example, It would be a surveillance software that would look for trading patterns that indicated someone was up to no good, and then do something about it. Send a message somewhere, send the transaction information somewhere, perhaps shut their system down, perhaps shut another system down, perhaps start something else up elsewhere. This kind of capability is very, very essential in today's world. However, this kind of software is not found in Microsoft, or not even in IBM. A small group of very esoteric software companies make this kind of enterprise software, and it is very pricey. So you can't afford to pick wrong. And I asked all my colleagues who are industry gurus, what would they recommend for this? My buddies recommended PTEC.
Indeed, it's not difficult to see why PTEC came so highly recommended. Given the nature of this sensitive risk management work, only a company with experience delivering software to large-scale organizations with secrets to protect would fit the bill, and in this regard, PTEC did not disappoint. Their client roster included a veritable who's who of top-level corporate and governmental clients: the FBI, the IRS, NATO, the Air Force, the Naval Air Command, the Departments of Energy and Education, the Postal Service, the U.S. House of Representatives, the Department of Defense, the Secret Service, even the White House. From the inner sanctum of the White House to the headquarters of the FBI, from the basement of the FAA to the boardroom of IBM, some of the best secured organizations in the world, running on some of the most protected servers housing the most sensitive data, welcomed PTEC into their midst. PTEC was given the keys to the cyber kingdom to build detailed pictures of these organizations, their weaknesses and vulnerabilities, and to show how these problems could be exploited by those of ill intent. But like all such systems, it could be exploited by those of ill intent for their own purposes, too. Given the nature of the information and secrets being kept by its clients, it should come as no surprise that many of PTEC's top investors and employees were men with backgrounds that should have been raising red flags at all levels of the government. And as it turns out, at least one of these men did raise red flags with a pair of diligent FBI field agents. In the late 1990s, Robert Wright and John Vincent, FBI special agents in the Chicago field office, were running an investigation into terrorist financing called Vulgar Betrayal. From the very start, the investigation was hampered by higher-ups. They were not even given access to the computer equipment needed to carry out their work. Through Wright and Vincent's foresight and perseverance, however, the investigation managed to score some victories, including seizing $1.4 million in terrorist funds. According to Wright,
"These funds were linked directly to Saudi businessman Yassin Qadi."
Yassin Al-Qadi is a multimillionaire businessman and philanthropist who, according to business associates, liked to boast of his relationship with former Vice President Dick Cheney. But in the late 1990s, he was sanctioned by the UN Security Council for his suspected links to Al-Qaeda, and after 9/11 he was put on a terrorist watch list by the U.S. Treasury for his suspected ties to terrorist financing. During the 1990s, as Vulgar Betrayal was being thwarted from opening a criminal investigation into his activities, the Qadi-backed investment firm Sarmony Limited became an angel investor to a software startup called PTEC, providing $5 million of the initial $20 million of capital that got PTEC off the ground. At the time, PTEC's CEO denied that Al-Qadi had any involvement with the company other than his initial investment, but the FBI now maintains he was lying, and that in fact Al-Qadi continued investing millions of dollars in the company through various fronts and investment vehicles. Company insiders told FBI officials that they were flown to Saudi Arabia to meet PTEC's investors in 1999, and that Al-Qadi was introduced as one of the owners. It has also been reported that Hussein Ibrahim, PTEC's chief scientist, was Al-Qadi's representative at PTEC, and Al-Qadi's lawyers have admitted that Al-Qadi's representatives may have continued to sit on PTEC's board even after 9/11. Ibrahim himself was a former president of BMI, a New Jersey-based real estate investment firm that was also one of the initial investors in PTEC and provided financing for PTEC's founding loan. PTEC leased office space and computer equipment from BMI, and BMI shared office space in New Jersey with Qadi International, owned and operated by none other than Yassin Al-Qadi. In 2003, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark said, "BMI held itself out publicly as a financial services provider for Muslims in the United States. Its investor list suggests the possibility this facade was just a cover to conceal terrorist support." Suhail Lahir was PTEC's chief architect. When he wasn't writing the software that would provide PTEC with detailed operational blueprints of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. government, he was writing articles in praise of Islamic holy war. He was also fond of quoting Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden's mentor and the head of Maktab al-Kidamat, which was the precursor to al-Qaeda. That such an unlikely cast of characters were given access to some of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. federal government is startling enough. That they were operating software that allowed them to map, analyze, and access every process and operation within these agencies for the purpose of finding systemic weak points is equally startling. Most disturbing of all, though, is the connection between PTEC and the very agencies that so remarkably failed in their duty to protect the American public on September 11, 2001.
Could you describe the relationship of PTEC with the FAA? Now, PTEC worked with the FAA for several years, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, they worked the FAA. There was it was a joint project between PTEC and MITRE, and they were looking at, it's interesting, they were looking at basically holes in the FAA's interoperability with responding with other agencies, law enforcement, in the case of an emergency such as a hijacking. So they were looking for the escalation process, what people would do, how they would respond in case of an emergency, and find the holes and make recommendations to fix it. Now, if anyone was in a position to understand where the holes were, PTEC was, and that's exactly the point. And if anybody was in a position to write software to take advantage of those holes, it would have been PTEC.
Now, was there a reference to PTEC having operated in the basement out of the FAA?
Yes. Now, typically, because the scope of such projects are so overarching and wide-ranging, when you are doing an enterprise architecture project, you pretty much have access to how anything in the organization is being done, where it's being done, on what systems, what the information is, and you pretty much have carte blanche. Now, if it's a major project that spans several years, the team that comes in has literally access to almost anything that they want because you're operating on a blueprint level, on a massive scale. So, yes, they were everywhere, and I was told that they were in places that required clearances. I was told that they had log-on access to FAA flight control computers. I was told that they had passwords to many computers that you may not on the surface think has anything to do with finding out holes in the system. But let's say you've said, okay, you isolated a part of a process of a notification process that was mediated by a computer, and you wanted to investigate it further, then you would typically get log-on access to that computer. And from that, back upstream or downstream, so who knows? You know, from my own experience, I could have access to almost anything I wanted to in JPMorgan Chase and didn't, for the reason I, if anything went wrong, I didn't want to have the access. But if you were up to no good as an enterprise architect with such a mandate, you typically could have anything you wanted.
So who was really behind PTEC? Did Ziadi, Ibrahim, and the others somehow evade the due diligence of all of the government agencies and multinational corporations that PTEC contracted with? Did PTEC just happen to end up working on the interoperability of the FAA and the Pentagon systems on the morning of 9/11? Did al-Qaeda's friend Dick Cheney really know nothing of Qaeda's connections or activities? Was this all some devious al-Qaeda plot to infiltrate key systems and agencies of the U.S. government? Not according to the people who were really investigating the company. So what did the 9/11 Commission have to say about PTEC? Absolutely nothing. The co-chair of the commission, Thomas Kane, had been involved in a $24 million real estate transaction with BMI, one of the PTEC investors, but no mention was made of that at the time, and the commission never looked into PTEC or its activities on 9/11. Meanwhile, Cheney's friend al-Qaeda has since been removed from the Swiss, European, UN Security Council, and US Treasury terrorist sanctions lists. And Robert Wright? After Vulgar Betrayal was shut down, the FBI did eventually raid PTEC's offices in December of 2002, but not before the company was given 2 weeks' advance warning of the raid. The very next day, then-Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge declared that PTEC in no way jeopardizes the security of the country. Osama Ziadi is still wanted by the FBI for lying about al-Qaeda's involvement with the company, but the case is now cold.
To the families and victims, of September 11th. On behalf of John Vincent, Barry Carmby, and myself, we're sorry.
The topic today is an adversary that poses a threat, serious threat to security of the United States of America. This adversary is one of the world's last bastions of central planning, governs by dictating five-year plans, a single capital that attempts to impose its command across time zones, continents, oceans, and beyond. With brutal consistency, it stifles free thought, crushes new ideas, disrupts the defense of the United States, and places the lives of men and women in uniform at risk.
On September 10th, 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld declared a new war. Not a war on a shadowy terrorist organization in Afghanistan, or even a war on terror itself, but a war on the Pentagon.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
Perhaps it is no surprise that Rumsfeld felt compelled to declare a war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy. The issue of the Pentagon's $2.3 trillion accounting nightmare had been dogging him since his confirmation hearings in January of 2001. Although Rumsfeld was interested in pushing forward a modernization of the military that was projected to cost an additional $50 billion in funding, that agenda was politically impossible in the face of the Department of Defense's monumental budget problem.
How can we seriously consider a $50 billion increase in the defense budget when DOD's own auditors, say the department cannot account for $2.3 trillion in transactions in 1 year alone? Now, my question to you is, Mr. Secretary, what do you plan to do about this?
Decline the nomination. Senator, I have heard...
I don't want to see you do that.
We'll stand adjourned in that case.
Senator, I have heard some of that and read some of that, that the department is not capable of auditing its books. It is... I was going to say terrifying.
Terrifying only begins to describe the problem. The Department of Defense's own Inspector General report for fiscal year 1999 noted that the Defense Finance and Accounting Service had processed $7.6 trillion of department-level accounting entries in that year. Of that amount, only $3.5 trillion could be properly accounted for. $2.3 trillion in transactions were fudged to make entries balance, run through without proper documentation, or made up entirely. The Inspector General's office did not even examine the other $1.8 trillion in transactions because they did not have adequate time or staff to review them. In 2002, one DFAS accountant blew the whistle on the problem and the cover-up that was underway to stop investigators from finding out where the money went.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on.
Jim Minnery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minnery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records.
The director looked at me and he says, "Why do you care about this stuff?" It took me aback, you know. My supervisor asked me why I care about doing a good job. So.
He was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off.
As controller of the Pentagon from 2001 to 2004, Dov Zakheim was the man tasked with solving this problem.
There are all kinds of long-standing rules and regulations about what you can do and what you can't do. I know Dr. Zackheim's been trying to hire CPAs because the financial systems of the department are so snarled up that we can't account for some $2.6 trillion in transactions that exist, if that's believable. And yet we're told that we can't hire CPAs to help untangle it in many respects.
Mr. Secretary, the first time and the last time that Dov Zackheim and I broke bread together, he told me you'd have a handle on that $2.6 trillion by now, but we'll discuss that a little.
We've got a handle. It's just a little hot.
From 1987 to 2001, Zackheim headed SPC International, a subsidiary of System Planning Corporation, a defense contractor providing air warfare, cybersecurity, and advanced military electronics to the Department of Defense and DARPA. SPC's radar physics laboratory developed a remote control system for airborne vehicles that they were marketing to the Pentagon prior to 9/11. Zackheim was also a participant in drafting Rebuilding America's Defenses, a document that called for a sweeping transformation of the U.S. military, including the implementation of the $50 billion missile defense program and increased use of specialized military technologies. The paper even noted how advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. Rebuilding America's Defenses was a white paper produced by the Project for the New American Century, a group founded in 1997 with the goal of projecting American global dominance into the 21st century. Joining Zackheim in the group were a host of other neocons who ended up populating the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Jeb Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld. In their September 2000 document, the group lamented that their plan for transforming the military was not likely unless a defining event took place, one that would galvanize public opinion. The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor.
We know that the thing that tends to register on people is fear, and we know that tends to happen after there's a Pearl Harbor, tends to happen after there's a crisis. And that's too late for us. We've got to be smarter than that. We've got to be wiser than that. We have to be more forward-looking. There's a wonderful book on Pearl Harbor by Roberta Wohlstetter and a foreword by Dr. Schelling that talks about this problem of seeing things happen and not integrating them in your mind and saying, yes, we need to be doing something about that now. That I reread periodically because it's so important.
And on 9/11/2001, America received its new Pearl Harbor. The attack on the Pentagon struck Wedge 1 on the west side of the building. An office of the U.S. Army called Resource Services Washington had just moved back into Wedge 1 after renovations had taken place there. The office was staffed with 45 accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts. 34 of them were killed in the attack. A 2002 follow-up report from the DOD Inspector General on the missing trillions noted that a further $1.1 trillion in made-up accounting entries were processed by the Pentagon in fiscal year 2000, but they did not even attempt to quantify the missing funds for 2001. The Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, later explained they were unable to produce a financial report for 2001 at all, due to the loss of financial management personnel sustained during the September 11th terrorist attack. Before becoming Secretary of the Army, Thomas White was a senior executive at Enron. Enron was one of the largest energy companies in the world, posting a $111 billion profit in 2000 before being exposed as an elaborate corporate accounting fraud in 2001. The SEC, which investigated the Enron scandal, occupied the 11th to 13th floors in World Trade Center Building 7, and their offices were destroyed on 9/11, destroying 3,000 to 4,000 documents on active investigations in the process. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy did not yield the results he promised. By 2013, The unaccountable money in the Pentagon's coffers had reached $8.5 trillion.
The latest scandal to hit Washington comes from a report revealing the Pentagon misplaced $8.5 trillion. Military leaders have also been found ordering subordinates to doctor books to hide the missing money. This is the conclusion of a special report by Reuters. One former Pentagon employee, Linda Woodford, said she spent 15 years there falsifying financial records. Woodford had a job checking Navy accounting records against figures supplied by the Treasury Department. She said money was missing from the report every month.
And national security expert Steve Miles is here with me to help us crunch these numbers. $8.5 trillion unaccounted for?
It's a lot of money. This is the kind of thing that you would think would bring Capitol Hill to a screeching halt. There'd be hearings kind of almost daily. You'd have various committees looking into it. None of that. It just leads to massive waste, and there can be all sorts of fraud that you don't know about. Just one example, when the Inspector General looked at Iraq, which was, you know, a lot of money, but in the grand scheme, just a portion of the money the U.S. spends. What they found was about $50 billion of the money the U.S. spent there was wasted. And about $6 billion was completely lost. They had no idea where it went. It was completely unaccounted for. But put that in perspective, that's about this amount of money that other countries would spend on their defense in a year total. And that's just the loose pocket change that we lost in the couch.
One thing I found very interesting in this report is that the Pentagon apparently uses a standard operating procedure to enter false numbers or so-called plugs to cover lost or missing information in their accounting in order to submit a balanced budget to the Treasury. So they can write in everything.
I mean, that's probably the most shocking part of this, is that they get to the end of the day and they say, oh, there's money missing. What do we do? Well, we'll just put a number in there that says it's there and we'll sort it out later. I mean, again, this is the type of operating practice that if you did it in your own business, if you tried to do it with your own taxes for the government, they'd haul you off to jail.
But then, given that the trillions have never been accounted for, and given that American defense spending soared to record levels after the attack, perhaps Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon, the one he announced on September 10th, was successful after all. And perhaps September 11th was the key battle in that war.
Some might ask, how in the world could the Secretary of Defense attack the Pentagon in front of its people? To them I reply, I have no desire to attack the Pentagon. I want to liberate it.
Insurance scams and insider trading, electronic fraud and vulgar betrayal, missing money and evidence destroyed. There are at least 8.5 trillion reasons to investigate the money trail of 9/11. Curious, then, that the U.S. government's final word on the attacks, the 9/11 Commission report, concluded that the money trail was not worthy of investigation at all. In Chapter 5 of the report, the Commission noted, "To date, the U.S. government has not been able to determine the origin of the money used for the 9/11 attacks. Ultimately, the question is of little practical significance." 9/11 was a crime, and as every detective knows, the first rule of criminal investigation is to follow the money. So why did the 9/11 Commission specifically reject this rule? The answers to 9/11 are not going to come from the suspects of the crime. Instead, it's up to investigators to continue to unearth the true evidence on the 9/11 money trail. Follow the money.
Now, last episode we looked at the Bilderberg as a European deep state milieu. Now, people have said, well, the Bilderberg group was behind these false flag terrorism events. I would say it's a milieu. It's a place where people can meet other people, where they can informally share their views or share their information. And it doesn't undertake operations as such. People there might commit to various courses of action, but those people, the deep politicians, are operating in multiple milieu. So they have a lot of different venues, some of them more public, some of them private. They might be holding public office, for example, so they'd be in a good position to say, yes, don't worry about the legal side of things. As far as my country is concerned, you won't face any investigation. You won't face difficulty there. So it's a milieu. Looking at the organization behind 9/11, we should not think of it as one guy in charge issuing orders pass down a hierarchy to other people. It can't be that simple. It's operating much more like a criminal syndicate. So people are liaising with other people. They might be accepting orders on a short-term basis. They might or might not be following those orders. They're doing what they think is best for them. I'm characterizing them mostly as sociopaths or psychopaths. If you think that's too cynical, well, then you can call them idealists, people who really are following what they believe in, and what they believe in happens to be that we need to organize, say, some false flag terror events because we want to start a war, and it'll all be good, and it'll be the best thing for America in the long run. So I don't want to seem too negative, but I also am aware that there's a huge gulf between what is said publicly and what is done privately. And doing the research on this, I've been writing up some of these people on wikispooks.com. Now, one thing that has really stood out is just how dirty these people are. They have quite a heavy degree of influence over the legal system, if not complete control. And still, they can't manage to seem to keep themselves out of jail, or their close friends get implicated. A lot of people suffering suspicious deaths. I mean, if people were actually interested in informing themselves, the veneer of respectability that hangs over certain people in the public eye is paper thin, and one look at the evidence, stuff just stinks. But to return to the topic of the insider trading, why did it range from, for example, Wirt Dexter Walker III and his wife buying 56,000 shares of Stratesec and profiting to the tune of around $50,000? Why did they even bother with that if they were part of a group which was making billions, hundreds of billions, or even trillions of dollars? Surely $50,000 either way is pretty small beer and not worth the risk of getting caught. Well, that question yields some insight, I think, into how these events are actually organized, and perhaps into why the SEC investigation was as extensive as it was. Now, the SEC is pretty much the canonical example of regulatory capture in the US. So if we assume that the deep state controlled the SEC, then they're fully aware that insider trading, financial profiteering was going on, and that the official narrative didn't want to include that, because that would be another whole level of complexity to say Al-Qaeda had a financial genius on the team who was busy profiteering from the US financial system. If they officially admitted that insider trading was going on, that might open up questions such as, why have we got a financial system which is effectively rewarding people, paying them for carrying out terrorist acts? So I can quite see why they wanted the official story to be, nope, not a trace of insider trading. It was just 19 guys with box cutters. That was kind of a simple story. So you might think, if that was the story, then the less investigation they did, the easier it would be for them to claim that was what they had come up with. You might think that a large, extensive investigation would just be making problems for themselves, because people would say, we showed you that information. Isn't it strange that you didn't bother to pass it on in the report? So, mulling this one over, I thought perhaps it's a giant cleanup operation, similar to, well, the Franklin child abuse scandal has now gone public. What are we going to do about this? Ah, let's get an investigative journalist to gather lots of evidence and credible witnesses, and then we can go through discrediting them and otherwise handling what they have to say. So could it be that the people who organized 9/11, and yes, they had their own very large financial frauds on a level of hundreds of billions or more, but in order to carry out 9/11 as a complex operation, then quite a number of other people had to have been told, not all the details. So people had some information, but not all. And this may have been enough for them to infer what was going to happen or at least enough for them to try and see if they couldn't profit from it anyway. So I think there was a lot of individuals decided, used some private initiative and said, well, I think we can make a bit of a money here, whether they were on a level of tens of thousands, millions, tens of millions of dollars, whatever the scale was, a bit of independent profiteering. And yes, there were probably some uninformed traders who were watching the market carefully and thought, ah, there's something going on here. They wanted to sort of piggyback on and say, well, I'm going to take out another call option to match that call option just because I have a hunch that these guys are not just bluffing. There's something going to happen. So I'm not an expert at financial crime, but thinking about how the deep state groups are organized, how these deep state events are planned, somebody who is a participant, a deep state actor, won't be getting all the information if they're not one of a very small number of individuals. And do we know, for example, that the people who managed the visa fraud and the flight training and so on, people who handed the stand-down exercises for the planes, did they even know that the towers that were going to be hit by the planes were then going to self-destruct? Or was that an entire addition to the operation as thought up by Larry Silverstein and someone else who managed to plant the explosives? Because it could have been an entirely separate operation that got piggybacked because Silverstein agreed with somebody, yes, these planes are going to fly into my buildings, I'm going to profit tidily from the insurance, then thought, hey, I wonder whether we wouldn't do better just to dispose of those buildings completely, have an empty field, and build some better buildings. Yes, could be worth looking into. So this is a difficulty when we're trying to fathom these plots, because it's not completely thought out in one room around a smoke-filled table by people planning what to do. That happens, but then other people improvise on top of these plans. Other people divert them or add to them or support them in their own way. I mean, they're aware the kind of people they're dealing with, and what is done is they're trying to do it clandestinely. And the one unspoken rule of these operations is that people must not find out what's actually going on. So factoring this together allows for some pretty complicated sequences of events to happen, which exceeds the capability of a few individuals in a room. It also stretches people's ability to keep these events secret. They have to rely on techniques such as assassinating witnesses, manipulating the corporate media, a whole battery of methods. But it's not easy with that many people taking individual decisions to organize these big events. Now, if you ask me what's the evidence that 9/11 didn't go according to plan, then I would say, without much hesitation, the biggest single piece of evidence is the fact that World Trade Center 7 blew itself up without being hit by a plane. I mean, it's quite an astonishing thing to happen, and as evidenced by the fact that it was broadcast on TV and barely known, barely talked about, until a video of that surfaced on the internet. I mean, that video existed. People had it. They couldn't process it. It was too weird. So why on earth would you organize for a building to spontaneously blow itself up? And then you have the preposterous claim that this was due to a fire started by bits of rubble landing in the building. I think it's a lot more likely that the plan was originally that a plane would fly into that building and, for whatever reason, perhaps it was shot down by a missile because passengers gained control of it, I don't know. For whatever reason, that didn't work according to plan. So that SEC investigation, could that perhaps have been a housekeeping operation? The original terms of involvement in 9/11 were, this is your mission, you will be paid this much, this will happen. You will not divulge any information to anybody. You will certainly not do any insider trading. You won't do anything that will increase suspicion or lead to accusations of foreknowledge. And some people couldn't resist the opportunity to get lucky on the stock market, and therefore this operation by the SEC could have been about identifying who were those people who didn't follow orders. We need to know this and take appropriate steps. So it is possible that they were actually looking for evidence of insider trading, but for their own purposes, not with the intention of informing the public. The fact that Ernst Welticke and all the other people who publicly, on the record, very soon after 9/11 said, look, well, there is obviously insider trader going on, that provides evidence to me of the ability of the deep state to cow people into submission. Now, three academic papers have been published claiming evidence of insider trading, so hats off to their authors who determined to follow the truth, whatever the cost. And I can't be too surprised that politicians and bank officials turned out to be easily bought when push came to shove. Now we continue with the soundtrack of a YouTube video. This is from 2012. I've uploaded it to the show's website. It's called 9/11 Conspiracy Solved, Names, Connections, Details Exposed. It's densely produced material. Seems to me to be pretty consonant with Corbett's analysis. If you'd like to watch it as well as listen to it, you can download it from this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/723.
In September 1991, shortly after the end of the Cold War, a cabal of elite bankers and intelligence spooks led by George H.W. Bush financed a $240 billion covert operations war chest through the purchase of 10-year securities that, as it happened, were scheduled to come due on September 12, 2001. Project Hammer was undoubtedly used for a wide variety of illicit intelligence operations, but mainly it was used to finance a covert economic operation against the collapsing Soviet Union, whereby unknown Western investors bought up much of the Soviet industry with a focus on oil and gas, crashing the Russian economy, looting its central bank, orchestrating what became known as the Great Ruble Scam, and a wide variety of other clandestine, state-assisted operations designed to thoroughly prevent Russia from ever contesting the U.S. as a world superpower. While in the process lining the pockets of these economic hitmen who swooped in to devour the collapsing Russian economy after the fall of the Soviet Union. A spectacular investment for all, at least until money laundering investigations began tracing all the money, or when the 10-year deadline came up and the securities became due and began the routine process of authenticity and ownership checks. Evidence shows that several federal and private investigations had already stumbled upon the Hammer Fund and were compiling evidence on it up until the 9/11 attacks. These included the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI, which was moved to the outer E-ring of the recently renovated section of the Pentagon that was targeted and destroyed on 9/11. According to E.P. Heidner, the ONI had been investigating crimes associated with the plundering of Russia. 39 out of the 40 people who worked in those offices were killed on 9/11, including the entire chain of command. The Pentagon's financial accounting offices in that same wing were also an obvious target, as were the passengers on board Flight 77, many of whom coincidentally held top-secret clearances and were connected with Pentagon black operations. Agents of the Office of Naval Intelligence had also been investigating financial transactions which were linked to securities being managed by those securities dealers in the World Trade Center that were also targeted. 31% of the 125 fatalities in the Pentagon were from the Naval Command Center that housed the Office of Naval Intelligence. 41% of the fatalities in the Twin Towers came from two companies that managed U.S. government securities, Cantor Fitzgerald and Eurobrokers. There were three major security brokers in the World Trade Center, Cantor Fitzgerald, Eurobrokers, and Garbin Intercapital. At 8:46 on the morning of September 11th, Flight 11 flew directly into Martian McLennan's secure computer room in the North Tower, right below the floor on which Cantor Fitzgerald was situated. Cantor Fitzgerald was the largest security dealer in the U.S. Shortly after that, a massive explosion went off just under the FBI offices in the North Tower on the 23rd floor. Fires were reported on the 22nd floor at 8:47. There were also explosions and subsequent fires reported at Garbin Intercapital on the 25th floor and in the basement of Tower 1 as well. Shortly thereafter, at 9:03, Flight 175 hit the South Tower right below the floors on which Eurobrokers was situated. In all three cases, the explosive, fiery destruction consumed the offices in the several floors above, destroying files and trapping victims inside. In the midst of all this, Building 6 was destroyed by an explosion that took place before either tower fell. This secondary explosion took out a portion of the building which just happened to include the El Dorado Task Force's offices. The El Dorado Task Force was an interagency money laundering watchdog group responsible for coordinating all major money laundering investigations in the U.S. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, these groups would be redirected to investigate terrorist financing. Building 6 was located directly between the North Tower and World Trade Center Building 7. While large portions of World Trade Center 6 were gutted by explosions and later by falling debris from the North Tower, the building itself did not suffer a global symmetric collapse at near freefall acceleration as did Buildings 1, 2, and 7. FEMA photographer and 9/11 whistleblower Kurt Sonnenfeld took some interesting pictures of the U.S. Customs vault in the basement of World Trade Center 6, which was found completely empty and left with the door wide open. All of its contents appear to have been looted during the attacks. There is also evidence that gold was being looted from the vaults beneath World Trade Center 4. There were several early reports of a 10-wheel truck packed with stolen bullion caught fleeing World Trade Center 5 when the vehicle had become stuck on a collapsed ceiling brace, forcing the driver to flee the scene. Many researchers have stumbled across one or two of these anomalies from time to time, the empty vaults, the secondary explosions, the fireproofing upgrades on the exact floors coinciding with failure and impact in the towers, the suspicious power downs and evacuation drills, the World Trade Center tenants and security firms like AIG, Marsh & McLennan, and Kroll, and their close ties with the intelligence community, etc., etc. These anomalies are not unrelated, but nevertheless became lost inside the chaos of that September morn, the aftermath, and subsequent cover-ups. Okay, so what does all this mean? Overall, a critical mass of brokers from the major government security brokerages in the Twin Towers had to be eliminated to create chaos in the government securities market. A situation needed to be created wherein $240 billion of covert securities could be electronically cleared without anyone asking questions, which happened when the Federal Reserve declared an emergency and invoked its emergency powers that very afternoon. On September 14th, the Securities and Exchange Commission declared a national emergency and for the first time in U.S. history invoked its emergency powers under the Securities Exchange Act Section 12K and eased regulatory restrictions for clearing and settling security trades for the next 15 days. These changes would have allowed the estimated $240 billion in covert government securities to be cleared upon maturity without the standard regulatory controls around identification of ownership. The towers needed to be demolished to create a big enough mess that the illicit activities taking place behind the scenes that morning could be hidden in the confusion of that day. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about who did it and how. 9/11 whistleblower Richard Andrew Grove was a software salesperson for a company called Silverstream. Silverstream's technology was on the cutting edge of internet solutions, offering software to web-enable the critical business functions of Fortune 500 companies, basically integrating and making available on the web the disparate legacy applications and mainframes while simultaneously streamlining workflow and traditional paper processes, with an end result being a lower cost of operation and more efficient transactions. Silverstream had built internet transactional and trading platforms for Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, Alex Brown, and Morgan Stanley, to name a few. Leading up to 9/11, Silverstream was designing specialized accounting software for a major client, Marsh & McLennan. Marsh is the world's largest insurance brokerage and was located right below Cantor Fitzgerald in the North Tower. Approximately 295 Marsh employees were murdered that morning along with other innocent victims and employees who either knew too much or too little about their chosen work environment. But most importantly, Silverstream provided a specific type of connectivity that was used to link AIG and Marsh & McLennan, the first two commercial companies on the planet to employ this type of transaction. What then were Marsh and AIG doing, and why did they need to leverage technologies that no other commercial entity on the face of the earth needed to use to conduct business? The recovered hard drives from the World Trade Center, combined with Richard Grove's testimony, give us some intriguing clues. Grove discovered that Silverstream was overbilling Marsh to the tune of $7 million extra dollars for fictitious and unneeded hardware. he also became aware of an exploitable flaw in the accounting software that had been sold to a variety of Marsh's clients and partners. When he brought this up to his superiors at Silverstream and others at Marsh, he was told to keep quiet and not to worry about it. But other friends of his at Marsh were also getting concerned and began documenting what was going on and raising concerns within the company. At last, they were finally granted a hearing with one of Marsh's high-ranking executives and were told to bring all their evidence to a hearing scheduled for 8:30 a.m. on September 11, 2001, on the 93rd floor. The high-ranking member of Marsh, who Grove did not name, would participate via teleconference from the safety of his home, while Marsh employees and potential whistleblowers, Gary Lasko, Catherine Lee, Ken Rice, Richard Bruhard, and John Oltzhofer would die in the meeting room in the North Tower with all their evidence when American Airlines Flight 11 would impact that very section of the building. Richard Grove, fortunately, got stuck in traffic that morning and didn't make it. Computer hard drives recovered from the World Trade Center show a spike in suspicious transfers that took place within the World Trade Center as the 9/11 attacks were unfolding. Richard Grove is convinced that these suspicious money transfers were performed electronically using Silverstream software, and that the overbilling of Marsh was hush money for the operations. It would certainly have helped clear up that $240 billion in securities and make it look like any of those companies might have done it. The recovered hard drives and financial transactions from 9/11 all show clear evidence that something was going on that morning. Marsh's CEO at the time was Jeffrey Greenberg, the son of Maurice Greenberg of AIG. Most insurance companies were hurting badly in late 2001 after $40 billion in insurance settlements had been paid out for the devastation caused by the 9/11 attacks. Yet one insurance company did not suffer quite the same losses as the other companies did. American International Group, or AIG as it turns out, is much more than an insurance company. With its long ties to the intelligence community, AIG was founded by OSS operative Cornelius V. Starr, two R's, the uncle of Clinton's friend Kenneth Starr. AIG currently operates a complex network of shell companies and other entities which operate internationally and have been used for clandestine intelligence gathering and other covert activities for decades. The company that ran security in the World Trade Center, Kroll Associates, was owned by AIG. The CEO of AIG on 9/11 was a guy named Maurice Greenberg, who was actually nominated for the position of Director of Central Intelligence after he authored a report for the Council on Foreign Relations, of which he's a high-ranking member, where he advocated that FBI and Drug Enforcement Agency agents operating abroad should not be allowed to act independently of either the ambassador or the CIA, lest pursuit of evidence or individuals for prosecution cause major foreign policy problems or complicate ongoing intelligence and diplomatic activities. Of course, this type of policy is essentially a continuation of things like Executive Order 12333 and the CIA-assisted contra-cocaine trafficking that went on as an immediate result. These backdoor agreements open the floodgates for government drug money laundering and narco-trafficking. Former LAPD narcotics detective-turned-whistleblower Michael Rupert has written a series of excellent articles documenting AIG's involvement in drug money laundering, undoubtedly revealing yet another motive for the invasion of Afghanistan, a country which currently produces over 90% of the world's heroin supply. Drugs are arguably the most profitable commodity on the entire international market, and drug money was undoubtedly a motive behind the invasion of Afghanistan and consequently the 9/11 attacks. While companies like AIG launder the drug money for big banks, the actual drug production and trafficking can be traced back to the same Iran-Contra affiliates like Richard Armitage and Frank Carlucci. Unfortunately, that rabbit hole is a bit too deep and off-topic to get into here. I will mention that DynCorp was heavily involved, as well as Stewart Air Force Base in upstate New York, where the two flights out of Boston crossed paths simultaneously and shut off their transponders before making their way to the Twin Towers. Many researchers believe that the MENA operation was moved to Stewart Air Force Base after Barry Seal got whacked. Richard Armitage was the Deputy Secretary of State on 9/11, and according to whistleblower Michael Springman, he was the man responsible for granting visas to 15 out of 19 of the 9/11 hijackers, allowing them to enter the U.S. and pursue flight training. Frank Carlucci is the chairman of the Carlyle Group and was in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, having just met with George H.W. Bush and the brother of Osama bin Laden on Carlyle Group business. Frank Carlucci was also the chairman of BDM International, a company that served as a front for State Department black operations. Frank Carlucci's employees at BDM International left to take charge of Stratasec, the World Trade Center and airport security firm. Corporate operating officer Barry W. McDaniel, an ex-military expert in logistics and materials distribution, and CEO Wirt Dexter Walker III, who is a distant Bush cousin from the Herbert Walker line, with an extensive history of managing CIA front companies. Marvin Bush, the president's brother, was also a board member at Stratasec. Although Stratasec maintained contracts for security upgrades, which were set to expire on September 11, 2001, they were not the company officially charged with World Trade Center security. This role was assigned to a risk management firm called Kroll Associates. Kroll's chairman, Jerome Hauer, was a longtime personal friend of ex-FBI counterterrorism expert John O'Neill and was responsible for O'Neill's appointment as head of security for the World Trade Center just a few days prior to the 9/11 attacks. O'Neill was the world's leading expert on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and was a potential 9/11 whistleblower with hard evidence of White House complicity in the protection and shielding of the 9/11 hijackers from all means of federal investigation. Al-Qaeda hijacking suspects were flagged by the Able Danger Terrorist Tracking Program, which was also shut down by the White House. Able Danger whistleblower Anthony Schaefer claims the U.S. government destroyed over 6 terabytes of data related to Able Danger, which he also claims identified 9/11 ringleader Mohammed Atta as early as February of 2000. Those atop the chain of command in the White House, military, and intelligence establishment deliberately ignored all the warning signs of an impending attack. A clever strategy of plausible deniability, which also served to portray those in charge as incompetent rather than complicit. In every major head throughout the chain of command on 9/11, from NORAD to the military, we see a repeated theme of complicity through negligence or incompetence. After 9/11, failure and incompetence was rewarded, and whistleblowers were silenced. Combined with the fact that 6 corporations control 90% of the media and CIA operations like Mockingbird admit to taking over and subverting our U.S. media, we can understand how such a big lie could have been kept from the American public for so long. But if you stop and take the time to do your research, you'll find all the evidence is there, hidden beneath a mountain of disinfo and lies.
It's been 10 years since 9/11 happened, and we are left with hundreds, if not thousands, of unanswered questions about the 9/11 attacks, a transparently fraudulent 9/11 Commission report which purposely failed to even mention the collapse of World Trade Center 7, and a host of ridiculous so-called debunking websites, forums, and other literature which have done absolutely nothing over the past 10 years to debunk anything other than cleverly selected strawman arguments, and have failed to stem the constant flow of new 9/11 information which researchers have been uncovering and bringing out to the public. Instead, they continue to label truth seekers, including family members of people who died on 9/11, as conspiracy theorists, and devise clever propaganda designed to prevent the general public from looking any further into the evidence or the actual claims of the so-called conspiracy theorists. In this video, we will take a deeper look into the so-called investigations, which have provided us with the official story, and why they deserve a more thorough examination.
The Bush administration stalled government investigations into 9/11 for over 400 days.
A week after 9/11, letters containing anthrax spores were mailed to several news media offices and 2 senators who were perhaps a bit too vocal about opening an official investigation into 9/11. The anthrax used in the attacks was identified as an Ames strain, which means it had to have come from the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases at Fort Detrick, Maryland. A member of that institute, Jerome Hauer, managed the National Institute of Health response to the anthrax attacks. Coincidentally, Hauer also warned the White House to start taking Cipro, an antibiotic which is effective against anthrax, a week before the attacks. Jerome Hauer also happened to be a managing director at Kroll Associates, which ran security at the World Trade Center up until the weekend before 9/11, when that role was personally handed off by Hauer to FBI agent John O'Neill, who would later die in the attacks, drawing strong suspicion that he was set up due to his knowledge of al-Qaeda and the 9/11 hijackers, whom he was blocked from investigating while he was working at the FBI. In January 2002, President Bush personally asked Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit the congressional investigation into the events of September 11th. The Bush administration only formed the 9/11 Commission after being prodded by the victims' families, who lobbied Congress for over a year to open the investigations. When the Bush administration finally did open a 9/11 investigation, it was described by some members as set up to fail.
The president has said only a minority of the commission can see a minority of the documents, and then they have to clear what they're going to say to the rest of the commission with the White House.
If you're one of those four that gets to see these documents, would that change your opinion?
No. They don't want any more eyeballs to see their documents than they can possibly get away with. It's a scam. It's absolutely disgusting.
They even attempted to appoint Henry Kissinger, a known cover-up mastermind, as head commissioner. He resigned after victims' family members asked him sensitive questions about his connections to the Bin Laden family and the Carlyle Group. Philip Zelikow wrote the conclusions for the report before the investigation ever began, and even then, any areas which did not support the official story were neither mentioned nor investigated by the 9/11 Commission. 6 out of 10 members of that commission have discussed on record how the government lied about the official story, and 70% of the questions posed by the victims' families were never answered or officially investigated. It's important to look at what happened to the evidence from 9/11. The day of 9/11, most of the FBI was in Monterey, California on an agency retreat.
Let's go to our State Department correspondent, Andrea Mitchell. Andrea, what can you tell us?
Well, this from the FBI. The State Department has been evacuated. There was a meeting going on in the Operations Center. Other top officials were in the Situation Room at the White House. Colin Powell is in Bogota, Colombia, on a two-day trip. But this very interesting information, Katie, Matt, and Tom, from the FBI, they had been operating a massive exercise from their hostage rescue unit. All of their top teams, about 50 personnel, helicopters, equipment, were in Monterey, California for the last 2 days, scheduled to fly back today commercially. So all of those people are out of place. It's fair to say, according to sources that we've talked to here at NBC, that the FBI rescue operations and other FBI operations are really in chaos right now because they can't reach their officials in New York. All of their phone lines are down, and now you've got all of their special experts on this stuck in Monterey, California, trying to get a military flight back because there are no longer commercial flights. So they are seriously out of pocket, and there is a real breakdown of the FBI anti-terror coordination team, which is, of course, the principal team that would lead any effort and was so effective under Jim Kostrom in New York City during the World Trade Center bombing and the TWA explosion, which, of course, turned out not to be terror.
Andrea, is the State Department...
This was essential for keeping the more experienced and honest members of the agency as far away from the crime scene as possible, while other agency insiders could be assigned to the investigations before their counterparts returned. Federal authorities such as FEMA and the CIA took immediate control over the crime scene and began whisking away evidence that very same night. Turner Construction, one of the primary contractors at Ground Zero, occupied the 38th floor of the North Tower and was involved in performing the fireproofing upgrades inside the towers. It has been noted that these upgrades were completed in the 3 years before 9/11 on floors that match up almost identically to the floors of impact and failure on 9/11. Once the cleanup was fully coordinated, the operations were consolidated under the control of two primary contractors, AMEC Construction Management and Bovis Lend-Lease. These are the two companies that were originally assigned to the areas of Ground Zero that included the North Tower, AMEC, and the South Tower, Bovis. A truly surprising fact is that at the time of the attacks on 9/11, AMEC had just completed a $258 million refurbishment of Wedge 1 of the Pentagon, which is exactly where American Airlines Flight 77 impacted that building. Arguments over the size of the hole of the Pentagon and whether it was a plane or a missile are, in my opinion, a convenient distraction from the much bigger picture of why that section of the building was targeted and by whom. On September 10, 2001, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion in unadjusted funds were missing from the Pentagon budget. The very next day, the offices whose responsibility it was for tracking that money down were destroyed when American Airlines Flight 77 impacted that very section of the building. The only off-site backup for the Pentagon's black budget financial records was a secure federal office building in the World Trade Center complex. Strangely, it too was destroyed on 9/11. World Trade Center 7 was the largest CIA headquarters outside of Langley, Virginia, and housed offices involved in several large-scale federal investigations into massive stock market and accounting fraud. Not surprisingly, World Trade Center 7 was the first to be cleaned up and the evidence destroyed at Ground Zero.
So if the Twin Towers in Building 7 were brought down in a controlled demolition, and the scientific evidence points to nanothermite, then who could have produced this and who could have put it in the buildings and how did they get it there?
In the impact zone of the North Tower was a company called Marsh & McLennan, which at the time was the world's largest insurance brokerage company. One of Marsh's executives was a guy named L. Paul Bremer, who was also the chairman of the Congressional National Commission on Terrorism from 1999 to 2000 and the U.S. Ambassador at Large for Counterterrorism from 1986 to 1989. Instead of going to work on the day of 9/11 and dying inside the towers with hundreds of his employees, Bremer decided to go on MSNBC and tell the world that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks and possibly Iraq and Iran. And then he demanded
the most severe military response we can come up with.
L. Paul Bremer was called away from Marsh in 2003 to become the Iraq occupation governor, a role he has been widely criticized for. So Bremer not only worked inside the buildings, but had offices directly in the impact zone of the South Tower where Flight 175 would hit. He missed work on 9/11 to give us the official story on national television and went on to be the Iraq occupation governor. You really can't get more connected to 9/11 than that. Oh wait, you can, sorry. I forgot to mention that Bremer was also the former manager for Kissinger Associates. He was a member of the board for AkzoNobel, the parent of International Paint Company, which produced a fireproofing application for skyscrapers called Interchar. Bremer was also on the international advisory board for the Japanese mining and machinery company Komatsu, which at the time had been involved in a joint venture agreement with Dresser Industries, the oil services intelligence front where Prescott Bush Sr. and George H.W. Bush got their start with Neil Mallon. Anyway, the Komatsu Dresser Mining Division operated from 1988 to 1990. And in July 1996, it patented a nanothermite demolition device that could, quote, demolish a concrete structure at high efficiency while preventing a secondary problem due to noise, flying chips and dust, and the like. As many of you know, residues of thermite, a highly energetic chemical mixture, have been confirmed in samples of World Trade Center dust, and the use of thermite at the World Trade Center was also revealed by environmental data. See the description for more links and sources. Scientific Applications International Corporation, a defense contractor with expertise in thermite-related technologies, played a large part in the NIST World Trade Center investigation. A few other names and companies inside the Twin Towers also worthy of further investigation include Craig Stapleton, who is married to Bush's cousin Dorothy Walker Bush. Stapleton was the president of Marsh Real Estate Advisors from 1982 to 2001. He was a member of the board of directors for Cendant, that was charged with massive accounting fraud in 1998, and went on to join Winston Partners, a privately owned investment firm founded in 1993 and led by George W. Bush's brother, Marvin. Other very powerful and well-connected people worked in senior management at Marsh. These included Stephen Friedman, a senior principal at Marsh Capital and former partner at Goldman Sachs, who later became George W. Bush's top economic advisor. Friedman was also a member of the Brookings Institution, the Bilderberg Group, the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and the board at InQtel, the investment firm founded by the CIA in 1998. InQtel invests in state-of-the-art technologies related to defense and intelligence work, including nano and chemical technologies, according to its website. In another interesting coincidence, Friedman belonged through Cornell University to a secret society called Quill and Dagger, the membership of which includes Paul Wolfowitz, Sandy Berger, and Stephen Hadley. Wolfowitz, the neocon deputy secretary of defense in the Bush administration, was the author in 1992 of the Wolfowitz Doctrine of Preemptive Warfare. He also made comments about a surprise like Pearl Harbor months before 9/11 and met with Pakistani ISI General Mahmoud Ahmed in the week before 9/11. Berger, the national security advisor to President Clinton, was later caught stealing documents from the 9/11 Commission investigation. Berger was also the boss of White House counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, and together with Hadley, who was Condoleezza Rice's deputy, was responsible for delaying or obstructing Clark's plans to stop al-Qaeda in January of 2001. Jeffrey Greenberg resigned from Marsh & McLennan after being accused of serious financial crimes. The first plane of 9/11 flew directly into his company's secure computer room in the North Tower. Jeffrey Greenberg is a member of the Brookings Institution and the Trilateral Commission. Jeffrey Greenberg rose quickly through management at Marsh, having come there directly from AIG in 1995, and then becoming CEO just 4 years later. At Brookings, Greenberg hobnobbed with Lee Hamilton, co-chair of the 9/11 Commission. There's also Jim Pierce, another Bush cousin, who was managing director of Aon Corporation, who, according to the NIST report, modified unknown sections of Floor 83 in the South Tower in 1997. Jim Pierce had arranged a meeting on the 105th floor of the South Tower for that morning. Pierce survived that day, despite the fact that 12 people came to the meeting in the South Tower and 11 of them died. The location of the meeting had been changed the night before to the Millennium Hotel, where Pierce watched the South Tower as it was hit by the aircraft. Apparently, the meeting attendees were not all notified of the change in location. Another interesting character is Joseph Caspudis of Baseline Financial Service, which occupied the impact zone of the South Tower on floors 77 and 78, where United Airlines 175 impacted. Caspudis has a history of being well connected to the highest levels of government, as well as to the defense and intelligence industries. Caspudis worked from 1972 to 1977 for the U.S. Department of Commerce and Defense. He was also the deputy director of Nixon's White House task force that dealt with the Arab oil embargo of 1973, and was instrumental in the creation of the Department of Energy. Caspudis went on to run a large corporation called Primark that had offices in both towers on 9/11. One of the subsidiaries of Primark, the Analytical Sciences Corporation, TASC, worked with so-called black or top-secret programs. TASC also worked closely with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Caspudis was also a member of the Logistics Management Institute, LMI, whose members included Paul Kaminsky of InQtel and General Dynamics, Charles DeBona of Halliburton, Skull and Bones member Joseph Samuel Nye, and Michael Daniels of Scientific Applications International Corporation. LMI's self-proclaimed role is advancing the science of government. Caspudi's connections to the DOE from 1977 through at least 1997 are interesting, considering that the DOE was developing thermite ignition devices as early as 1983. Joseph Caspudis went on to become the CEO of Baseline Financial Services, which was directly in the impact zone on the 78th floor of the South Tower. According to NIST, Caspudis Baseline Financial modified the southeast corner of floor 78 in 1999, exactly where the aircraft hit on 9/11. Floors 77 and 78 were upgraded for fireproofing in June and April of 1998, respectively. Another company of interest on floor 91, just above the impact zone for the South Tower, was Washington Group International. This company was known primarily as a construction and mining firm, and it had just acquired Raytheon Engineers in July of 2000. In 1996, Washington took over Morrison Knudsen, an engineering and construction firm that had a history of working on large-scale projects around the world, including in China, Iran, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. The Army Corps of Engineers hired Morrison Knudsen to demolish over 200 buildings in 1995. One of the DOE facilities for which Washington was responsible well before 9/11 was the Savannah River site near Aiken, South Carolina. In February of 1997, Lawrence Livermore National Labs and the Savannah River site signed an agreement of cooperation to share technology. Savannah went on to add developing Sol-Gel technology for fuels and other applications to its portfolio. Sol-Gel technology is utilized by Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories for making nanothermites. In another coincidence, Savannah River technology staff participated in the search and rescue operations at Ground Zero by providing unique tools. Just before 9/11, Washington was going through a tough time financially and sought Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Securities and Exchange Commission documents show that Washington made court-ordered pre-petition payments as part of these proceedings to a number of companies, including Komatsu. Washington also made payments to Greenhorn and O'Mara, whose employee Teresa McAllister was a lead author of the FEMA and NIST reports on the World Trade Center disaster, and to Sumitomo Bank, which was closely allied with Komatsu. Building 7 was a 47-story federal office building in the World Trade Center site, which collapsed at 5:20 p.m. on the afternoon of 9/11. This building was home to the CIA, in fact, the largest CIA headquarters outside of Langley, Virginia. It also housed offices for the Secret Service and the Securities and Exchange Commission. One of the most interesting tenants, however, was then-Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management and its Emergency Command Center on the 23rd floor. This floor received $15 million worth of renovations, including independent and secure air and water supplies, and bullet and bomb-resistant windows designed to withstand 200-mile-per-hour winds. Mayor Giuliani was a former U.S. prosecutor for the South District of New York from 1983 to 1989, who was in charge of investigating the terrorist financing Bank of Credit and Commerce International. After he left his job as a prosecutor to start a political career, he worked for a law firm called White & Case that actually represented BCCI. So he went from prosecuting the BCCI to working for a law firm which defended the BCCI. This was likely his foot in the door of this underground corporate criminal network. Giuliani would later help to destroy all the crime scene evidence from Ground Zero. Giuliani's sidekick on 9/11 was Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, who appeared to be coaching some of Rudy's actions that day, keeping him away from the media and even answering questions for him about explosives in the buildings. In fact, Bernard Kerik gave us the first official government pronouncement that no explosives were involved in the destruction of the World Trade Center buildings. Kerik's department was also the same one that found that pristine, completely undamaged hijacker's passport, which survived a plane impact and fireball, which destroyed two titanium black boxes and three towers. Yeah, Kerik would later receive a nomination from President Bush to become Director of Homeland Security, which he declined for personal and political reasons, and instead took a job training the Iraqi police force in Iraq alongside L. Paul Bremer. Both men are credited for turning Iraq into the unwinnable quagmire it is today. In February of 2010, Kerik was sentenced to 4 years in federal prison for conspiracy and fraud charges, unrelated to the crimes of 9/11, unfortunately, but it still goes to show you what kind of person he is. Definitely the kind of person you'd want inside the New York City police force during a staged event like 9/11. And lastly, we have the Pentagon. It's certainly peculiar, to say the least, that Al-Qaeda terrorists hell-bent on destroying the USA would not crash their plane into the north wing of the Pentagon, where all the most important offices were, like Donald Rumsfeld, John Ashcroft, etc., and that they would instead choose to target the one section of the Pentagon that had most recently been refurbished to withstand missile impacts. It's also interesting to note that the company which completed the $258 million refurbishment to Wedge 1 of the Pentagon was also hired as a contractor to clean up Ground Zero in New York City. Wedge 1 also coincidentally housed the Pentagon's budget analyst office, where DOD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that was reported missing by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in a press conference the day before 9/11. The Pentagon's comptroller in charge of that money at the time was an interesting fellow named Dov Zakheim, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and a contributor to the neocon think tank Project for the New American Century. Zakheim helped write the PNAC document Rebuilding America's Defenses, in which he is credited for the line which states, "Further, the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor." Several members of the Bush administration, including President Bush himself, would later refer to 9/11 as a new Pearl Harbor.
A respected and established voice in the intelligence community, his views were eagerly accepted. And Dov went from his position at Systems Planning Corporation to become the comptroller of the Pentagon in May of 2001. Perhaps not so coincidentally, it was an SPC subsidiary, TriData Corporation, that oversaw the investigation after the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center in 1993. SPC, according to their official website, specializes in many areas of defense technology production and manufacture, including a system developed by their radar physics group called the Flight Termination System, or FTS. This is a system used to destroy target drones, craft that would be fired on by test aircraft or weaponry, in the event of malfunctions or misses. This highly sophisticated wargame technology allows the control of several drones from a remote location on varying frequencies and has a range of several hundred miles. This technology can be used on many different types of aircraft, including large passenger jets. According to the SPC website, a recent customer at that time was Eglin Air Force Base, located in Florida. Eglin is very near another Air Force Base in Florida, MacDill Air Force Base, where Dov Zakheim contracted to send at least 32 Boeing 767 aircraft as part of the Boeing-Pentagon tanker lease agreement. As the events of September 11, 2001 occurred, little was mentioned about these strange coincidences and the proximity of Dov Zakheim and his group. Since there was little physical evidence remaining after the events, investigators were only left with photographic and anecdotal evidence. This is a photograph of the Flight Termination System module from their site. Note it has a cylindrical shape and is consistent with the size and shape of the object observed under the fuselage of Flight 175. The Boeing lease deal involved the replacement of the aging KC-135 tanker fleet with these smaller, more efficient Boeing 767s, which were to be leased by Dov Zakheim's group.
planes were to be refitted with refueling equipment, including lines and nozzle assemblies. In this enlargement of Flight 175, we can clearly see a cylindrical object under the fuselage and a structure that appears to be attached to the right underside of the rear fuselage section. When seen in comparison, it is obvious that the plane approaching the Trade Center has both these structures, the FTS module, and the mid-air refueling equipment, as configured on the modified Boeing 767 tankers. Of particular interest is the long, tube-like anomalous structure under the rear fuselage area of 175. This structure runs along the right rear bottom of the plane. The equipment attached to the underside of the plane which hit the World Trade Center is identical in every single way to the Boeing 767s issued by Dov Zakheim.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Bring it back.
The video you're watching now came from Loose Change First Edition.
Did you catch that?
It appears to show the FTS pod self-destructing just before impact.
Also, notice that the flash is reflected in the fuselage of the plane. Flash is also present in footage taken by Evan Fairbanks, Jennifer Spell, and CNN. Al-Qaeda certainly couldn't have died of this equipment at Logan International Airport. And even if they did, the flight crew would have noticed it. So where did this plane come from?
Another interesting piece of 9/11 evidence is the last 12 seconds of UA-175. Since every amateur videographer in New York City had their cameras pointed up at the burning Tower 1, the second plane strike was filmed from nearly every conceivable angle. Expert analysis of this plane leads to some startling revelations. First, there is the expertly controlled flight characteristics of this plane. During its last 12 seconds of flight, UA-175 made a single corrective maneuver so perfectly timed and executed that it's unlikely it was piloted by human hands.
One of the things that jumped out at me when I looked at the footage of the video of Flight 175 as it went into the World Trade Center is it appeared to me that there was something on the under fuselage of that aircraft that did not belong there, at least not with a commercial airliner. Now, I'll tell you where I have seen attachments that look like that on military aircraft. So the question we have to answer now is, was that the commercial airliner that hit the World Trade Center, or possibly was it an aircraft that looked very similar but was a military type airplane?
All the recorded sources, all the different photographic evidence that was produced by CNN and ABC, they all show this pod. It's there. You can see it with your own eyes. And in my professional opinion, that there was a pod attached to the bottom of that aircraft, and therefore it was not United Airlines Flight 175.
If you take a careful look at the flight paths of American Airlines 11 and UA-175, the two flights that took off from Boston's Logan Airport and crashed into the Twin Towers, you'll find a major clue. Not only did both these planes cross paths directly over Stewart Air Force Base, but they did so at the exact same time. Another odd synchronicity is Flight 93, which had been sitting on the tarmac delayed at the airport for nearly 40 minutes with no explanation. Originally scheduled to take off at 8:01 a.m., it was delayed until the moment that Flight AA-11 crashed into the North Tower at 8:43 a.m. Another interesting piece of evidence that ties Stewart Air Force Base to the center of this 9/11 conspiracy is the white mystery plane spotted over Washington and the Pentagon. Through careful investigation, we've been able to map out the flight paths of these two ominous aircraft, which have been identified as E-4Bs, a type of aircraft that the military uses as mobile command posts. What concerns me is that both of these aircraft took off from and landed at Stewart Air Force Base. Another interesting coincidence I found was that Flight 93 turned around directly over Hopkins Airport, and Flight 77 turned around directly over Tri-State Airport. Webster Tarpley has done some of the most thorough research into the war game exercises that were taking place on the day of 9/11. But this white mystery plane, the Doomsday Plane, What was it doing over the Pentagon and the White House on 9/11? Who was flying in that plane? What were they doing? Being the comptroller for the Pentagon and the chief financial officer, you have to kind of wonder what Dov Zakheim was doing on 9/11. What his connections were to the $2.3 trillion that were missing from the Pentagon the day before 9/11.
If anything, the individuals and organizations outlined in this video are at least as suspicious as the 19 hijackers themselves. Makes my guns talk
best. The Rangers and deputies. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. This show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/723, also has links to the original material from James Corbett and to the video from YouTube. Last episode, I was in error. I announced that this would be an episode on Operation Gladio. Well, I'm still waiting for more volunteers, so I think we're going to be one episode late. I do expect next episode to be Operation Gladio, and if you'd like to take part, if you'd like to help reading one or two voices from the Operation Gladio film, then being a native speaker in English is not needed, as long as you have a clear speaking voice. If you have a French or Italian accent, so much the better, but it's not too late to take part. So if you're interested, you can email me unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Vandana Shiva's celebration of Gandhi's home rule. It was extraordinary to hear the world-renowned philosopher, physicist, environmental activist and eco-feminist Dr. Vandana Shiva speak in a small former logging town in Northern California. The Little Lake Grange in Willits, living symbol of the 150-year-old national self-organization of Grange farmers, was filled to capacity. There were third-generation elder ranchers and members of the emerging new movement of young farmers, and many young and old who are participating in the projects for Willits' economic localization. Much of that is focused on food growing, local industry, and alternative energy, but also on local stewardship for the rivers and forests in the county. The audience included veterans of literally decades of fierce opposition to, and even some victories over past and current permissive California state rules on logging and the use of toxins on land and water. In part one of her talk, Vandana Shiva spoke about Gandhi's home rule. Gandhi discovered that resistance against British rule would take its strength from combining literally thousands of local efforts. Today, home rule is an element of living history within the many successful efforts of localization. So here's the Great Hall of the Willits Grange, ceiling fans turning slowly, back doors open to the summer night, and neighborhood dogs trying to get inside. In a moment, you will notice the voices of children mixed in with the comments and cheers from the audience. A reminder who ultimately will benefit from localization, organic food, and the urgently needed restrictions on corporate rule. Dr. Vandana Shiva.
I've worked now 30 years on issues of agriculture. It isn't the subject I chose. I mean, I was passionate about physics. I studied quantum theory. And I mean, even to now, you know, sometimes see a paper, I get nostalgic, but then I say, no. The earth needs your service. And over 30 years, I have found that every claim of industrial agriculture is a false claim. It begins with saying we produce more food. Industrial agriculture has never produced more food because it never produces food in the first place. It produces commodities for trading, and commodities don't nourish us. And because commodities don't nourish us, they end up actually destroying our health, which is why there's such an epidemic of food-related diseases. And because the US has had the longest period of commercial use of GMOs, if you were to take new disease epidemics, new, the highest are in this country. Literally, the freedom of corporations like Monsanto to make profits is at the cost of our children to be healthy. It's at the cost of the planet's health. And the price is becoming too heavy. You know, I don't mind giving a little concession, say, okay, some profits, all right. But these are obscene profits because they are being extracted through processes of ecocide when it comes to the planet, and genocide when it comes to people. Ecocide basically means the crime of destroying ecosystems, species, the soil, the atmosphere. Wherever BT crops or Roundup Ready crops are used, the soils are dying. Wherever they are used, pollinators are dying. The Roundup Ready use killing the milkweed, which is where the monarch butterfly nests, that evidence is out. But long ago in Cornell, there was a study where they fed the monarch larvae GM corn pollen and non-GM pollen. The larvae that ate the non-GM pollen did fine. All the butterflies that were fed, the BT corn larvae, died. Early studies were showing us this. Destruction of diversity of species at every level, within the soil, above the soil, plants, beneficial insects. Pesticides had begun the problem. And I, in fact, prefer to call GMOs poison-producing plants. You know, they have an organization. The poison industry has an organization called Crop Life. Literally. And it's this association that threatened Michelle Obama when she started an organic garden in the White House. They wrote to President Obama and said, this is sending a bad message. So ecocide is there in every study that we're seeing, but not just studies, indicators. I mean, look at what's happened to Argentina. Look at what's happened to Brazil. My country, the only crop they managed to push through was a cotton, BT cotton. There is not a single pollinator in the BT cotton plant. Not one. We're doing a study on the soil. The bacterial population is 250% less than the organic. And it's declining. Every year it's declining. Why do I call it a genocide? I call it a genocide because never before have seeds been the reason of wiping out hundreds of thousands of farmers. Seeds have been the source of life. Every culture has said you've got to save the seed. You've got to save the seed so that the future is guaranteed. And there's a very famous story from the history of my region. I come from the Himalaya, from Doon Valley. I was born there. I've returned there to do this work, start the farm, start the Earth University. And in fact, I've left my colleagues. We have 50 participants studying agroecology and organic farming right now. I've left them to be with you because I just feel so deeply that what you do in California is significant for the U.S. and for the world just now. So in our area in Dehradun, we have replanted diversity. We grow more than 2,000 crop varieties that we've saved. We've created 120 community seed banks. We call them community because we believe seed is a commons. And in this region, in the 1815, when the British came and there were wars and the typical things that happen, people in the villages died of hunger. And yet, in every home, you know these squashes that you have? The squashes are used as seed containers in the high mountains. They're called tomris. Every tomri was full. People did not touch the seed. Because to destroy seed is sin. And now there's a deliberate destruction of seed. There's a deliberate destruction of seed by creating seeds that don't renew. Monsanto bought up Delta and Pineland, which had the patent on the Terminator technology to create sterile seeds. But even otherwise, I'm right now fighting a whole attempt to introduce a GMO mustard, which is using genes for sterility. Seed is the very symbol of fertility. And it has to be hubris to try and induce sterility. But there's also the prevention of renewal of seed through law by criminalizing seed saving. Now, when all of this comes together, seed that has always been the basis of our food, the basis of our farming, is both becoming the danger to our food and the danger to farming. So when Monsanto entered India, the first trial started in 1998. They brought in the BT cotton for experiments in 95. 98, they started field trials. And, you know, they are so arrogant, they put full-page ads in the Indian newspapers saying next year Indian farmers will be getting Bolgard, which is the trade name of their BT cotton. I read this, I rang up our environment ministry, I said, did they get approval? They said, no. I rang up our agriculture ministry, I said, did they get your approval? No. So I filed a case in the Supreme Court, they were stopped. But then, of course, you know, they were stopped for 4 years, by then they find, you know, we'll bribe so-and-so official in that minister, and they managed to lubricate the machinery, very much like they lubricate the machinery in Washington, D.C., you know, I have watched over all of these years, officials in Washington don't change. It could be Democrats, it could be Republicans. It could be Bush, it could be Obama. The same people stay. The same Michael Taylors, the same people. There was, of course, this term of revolving draw, you know, Monsanto and back. But now they don't even have to revolve. They just sit. They feel so confident that no one can touch them. So eventually when Monsanto did start to commercialize, they increased the price of cottonseed 80,000%. Now, you know, farmers don't have that kind of money, so they're given the seed on credit. And usually, you know, the local seed agent, who's the agent of Monsanto, say, just put your signature here. And then they fill in the rest. It's against land. 3 years later, they come and say, you haven't paid, so your land is now ours. That's the day for farmer will quietly go to his field. Our Indian farmers, the land is the mother. And the idea that that land is being taken away, that day they go to the field, drink pesticide, go to the moneylender the last time, to the agent of the pesticide and seeds, last time to borrow, but now for pesticide only, and drink it. And every case I know, the widow is informed by someone who saw the farmer's body in the field. A cottonseed, BT, non-BT looks the same. The poor wife had no idea they were getting into debt till the husband takes his life. You know what the number of farmer suicides in India since Monsanto entered our seed supply? 300,000 now. 300,000. Now, I call that a genocide because it's deliberate. According to the United Nations, harm caused to a group of people by another group is genocide. Deliberate harm. Usually it's recognized in the context of ethnic cleansing. But this is a kind of ethnic cleansing if you think of small farmers as an ethnic group. They are a community of small farmers whose most important vocation is to serve the earth, protect the soil, save the seed, bring us good food. In my view, nobody else plays so many vital roles for the planet and for society as small farmers do. And that's why I've dedicated my life to protecting seeds on the one hand and serving small farmers on the other, including changing this bias that small farmers are a species that can be allowed to disappear. That somehow food will come from anonymous sources about which we don't have to think. I've had debates with biotech industry representatives who said, but Dr. Shiva, get used to the fact we'll be eating pills. I said, no, don't say we, say you. I want real food from real soil, real hands, real seed. And I'm going to do everything to keep that option alive. But there's another dimension to genocide. Because I think deliberate harm to future generations. I'm a member of a council called the World Future Council. And we got together because the future was totally being ignored. And future generations were being ignored. Their rights were being ignored. I come from a culture just like the Native American culture, which thought in terms of the seventh generation. We said, whatever you do, think of the seventh generation to come. If what you do will benefit them, take that action. If it'll harm them, seven generations down the line, don't. Now, that's the reason we had sustainable societies. These days, politicians think in four-year terms. Corporations think in three-month terms. The financial world thinks in seconds. The blip on the risks of the graphs that go up and down. You know, if there's an attention deficit disorder, it's in the economic system. They can't pay attention. They definitely cannot pay attention to the future. So if, on the one hand, you look at the farmers of India and 300,000 suicides, and then you look at the children of this country and their health, that too is a genocide. Monsanto knew in 1985 that glyphosate is a carcinogen. And now when the WHO announced it, they tried to pounce on the WHO because they got used to pouncing on so many scientists and putting pressure to get papers retracted, scientists fired. I could go on and on about all my friends who've lost jobs. The only reason I haven't, I gave it up voluntarily in 1982. There's nothing they can take away from me. So knowingly, they have caused harm. I'll give you a very simple example. They always say Roundup can't affect human beings because we don't have something called the shikimate pathway, which is what plants have and bacteria have. And it's because the plants have it, when they spray Roundup, it disrupts that pathway and it kills the plant. That's how it works as a herbicide. What they ignore or deliberately don't tell us is this human body is 600 trillion cells, most of which are bacteria. Only 600 million are human. All those cells in our gut are getting knocked out with glyphosate residues. And if you look at the inflammatory diseases, the intestinal disorders, the fact that it's the bacteria in the gut that produce the enzymes that help the neurotransmitters, when you realize that the gut and the brain is connected, they are stealing our brains. Yes, this deliberate harm with full knowledge is a crime. We are organizing to put all of these different strands together because I think people should know how severe the crimes against nature and humanity are.
Yes.
And for anyone who thinks their little action in their local community is insignificant, we live in an interconnected world. And in an interconnected world, it doesn't matter where you begin the change. The change ripples through the web. That's the beauty of a web. And in the web of life, it is only the local where positive action will take place. Exactly. For three reasons. First, life is local. You know, even the amazing hydrological cycle of this planet, it begins with little droplets. The clouds are formed with little droplets. The oceans are formed with little droplets. Our relationship with the Earth can only be local. Astronauts can get impressed with the picture of the blue Earth. But they can't serve it. They can't go put organic matter in that soil from their spaceship. Just as much as you can only take care of your children when you're actually there. Though they are, of course, doing a lot of IT innovation to keep track of what's happening to your baby you left behind in the crib while you went to watch a movie. You know, you got a camera, you got this, you got that. And there is, the next step of Monsanto insanity is they really think we are going to give up our relationships of love, our relationships of care, for their control of data. Because all of the herbicide tolerance failed, the BT toxin has failed, nothing's working for them. Which is why they tried to buy Syngenta and that failed. Then they started to buy data. So they bought the climate data, soil data, and they're planting articles in newspapers. Big data means big brain. Just like Monsanto doesn't have a brain, as I said. In fact, big data means no brain. We did a lovely manifesto from this commission in Tuscany that I chair, and we called it the Knowledge Manifesto. And we wrote it in 2008 at the peak of the financial crisis. How is it that we've reached the stage where things are going so wrong and we can't make correction? And in that, we have a whole section on information obesity. And just like, you know, too much salt, too much sugar, too much wrong fat, not very good for our body. Obese body is not a healthy body. Obesity of information is not more knowledge and definitely not more wisdom. And we need more knowledge and we need more wisdom. And we need all of this with the ability to act in order to make everything better for our communities, for the earth, for our neighbors. And what you started here in Mendocino with a GMO-free and now you're taking it to the chart, it's become so relevant because the California government is trying so hard to make life easy for Monsanto. Your charter needs to correct that. I had suggested that, you know, go exchange seat 3.1 miles and you all did it, you know, but do it again. It's going 3.1, 3.5, 5, 10, whatever, wherever, exchange seats and send messages to the people in Sacramento. Come and receive the seats from us. And this is so important. This is why your county charter is so important. Clause 4 says the bill would also prohibit a city, county, district, including a charter city or county, from adopting or enforcing an ordinance on or after January the 1st, 2015, that regulates plants, crops, seeds without consent of the secretary. They're trying to take away your freedom. Just as much as the DARK Act, the denial to the Americans of the right to know, is trying to take away the freedoms that have been exercised by the state of Vermont, which passed a law on labeling. Or Hawaii, County of Maui, which said we won't have GMOs. So they're going to higher level to preempt and take away the powers at local levels that are enshrined in constitutions. Monsanto can only sell GMOs by destroying constitutions. So if one big illusion was we produce food and solve the problem of hunger, the second big illusion is we breed better seeds. The best seeds have been bred either by farmers or public institutions, both of which were guided by the values of serving the public good, maintaining enriching diversity, enhancing the taste, quality, nourishment of food, and creating resilience. That's the kind of work we do in Navdanya. We do participatory breeding. We do now with a very famous Italian scientist who worked in Syria for years. We do evolutionary breeding. Because with such rapid climate change, it's the intelligence of the seed that has to guide us to adaptation. We save seeds that are adapted, seeds that can tolerate salt, seeds that can tolerate floods or drought. So another dimension of GMOs is it cannot exist without piracy. Cannot exist without piracy from nature or farmers. Our task is given to us. Our task is to protect the diversity of the earth, of our seeds, to create local food system. There's not a country where globalization has improved food security. Not a country. It has taken food security away. Countries that were producers of food are now importers of food. Mexico, that had enough corn, is today importing corn. And they're fighting the GMO corn of Monsanto. Because for them, they are corn. They are the people of corn. They are the culture of corn. We know that the only food that's real food comes from the soil we know and a community we know. So we have to create food communities. And localization has to be the future of food system. Globalization can be a short-term future of food commodities, which bring profits to Monsanto for seed, Cargill for trade, Kellogg's and the others, who all joined up to undo your labeling mallet. You know, you want to know who's messing up the food system, they're all there in a list. They made it easy for you. They said, we are messing up. Now all we have to tell them is keep out. The earth has the capacity, we have the capacity through our local democracy to create the kind of food systems that serve the earth and serve us and the future. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of an hour-long talk by the Indian ecologist, philosopher, and seed saver Vandana Shiva. She co-founded and leads Navdanya, which promotes seed saving and organic farming and has more than 70,000 pharma members. Vandana Shiva has served as an advisor to governments in India and abroad, as well as to NGOs, including the International Forum on Globalization. In 1993, she received the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. Vandana Shiva wrote many books, among them Soil Not Oil and Stolen Harvest. You can hear this talk as well as part one for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Open the newest programs page and scroll down. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. You can contact TUC Radio online at tucradio.org. The email is tuc@tucradio.org. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You cannot provide better for your community, but when you are spiritually responsible for your community. And this spiritual responsibility is when you acquire, when you respect the vision of your ancestors and the vision of your future generations. Both ancestors and future generations being in front of you and you taking responsibility for them. To honor your ancestors, but also to provide for your future generation, even if they are not flesh and bone nowadays. They are in the spirit world and they are watching you.
That's the voice of Marcelo Saavedra. On this week's show, we speak to Marcelo about the need to be a good ancestor in dealing with today's contemporary problems. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged to be joined by Aymara Elder Marcelo Saavedra. He's a professor at the University of Ottawa. We're very privileged to have him on our program tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, hello.
I want to perhaps create a space for a conversation, because we live in a world with a lot of distancing, not just from the natural world, but from each other. And when we look at Canada as a whole, as a country that it's in many ways facing many crises, ecological crisis, a crisis of poverty, a crisis, not just poverty in terms of resources, but the inequality that allows poverty to become normalized. So let's begin by talking a little bit about what grounds you, what connects your resistance and your political activism within this context. As an Indigenous man from Aymara, from Bolivia, what grounds you and what orients you?
Yes, for me it is very important to acknowledge the thing that's happening over time in our own being as human beings and from Mother Earth. We, in our culture, we believe that we come out of Mother Earth. we embody all these sacred elements, and eventually we forget that sacredness. And that's why we are in this state of affairs nowadays, in which we are trying to destroy our home at a pace never seen in history before. And that's what's really, really sad for me, but I think it's also the driver of why we are not respecting what we should respect the most, which is our common heritage, which is Mother Earth. This is our planet. There is not going to be another planet waiting for us out there. This is the only one, and we have to live our lives guided by the sacred teachings that our ancestors gave us, to walk through these lives in who we are, which is sons and daughters of Mother Earth.
Now, when we think about the challenges we face as a society that sees the world organized according to economics, you know, we have been told that there's been an economic collapse. We know we've been in the cycle of, you know, an economic collapse, which is part of living in a capitalist system. Can we talk a little bit about the cycles that have been normalized, and how do we break them out of this addition of seeing the world through so-called the logical mind? You know, the logical response to an economic crisis is to create more economic boosts, even if that means more of the things that have brought us the erosion of the land, the destruction of our waters, the destruction of our soil. How do we break out of that mindset?
In our age, we have been blinded by the economic crisis, and also about the economic booms that we have lived through our lives. Beforehand, our ancestors, they acknowledged that the planet used to go through different cycles of existence, and we used to preserve that memory with our legends and our prophecies. But nowadays, with the advent of modern sciences, we tend to forget that those legends and those stories and those prophecies, they were recounting the story of Mother Earth through its passage through time and through space. And nowadays, we just tend to think that capitalism is an economic system that has always existed and will always exist, and that nothing is further from the truth. Because if you look at this present cycle, this is only a very small piece of the overall history of humankind, and a very strange stage, to say the least, you know, in which we believe that the economics is going to dictate everything that we do as human beings. Actually, in ancestral times, the economic cycle was only a small place within the bigger picture, which was the social tissue that societies, in which societies were embedded. But nowadays, we don't think about those things anymore. Rather, we tend to think that everything is going to be determined by economic priorities or by economic models, and we measure everything in economic terms. Like, you know, for instance, we cannot think of anything in terms of intrinsic values. We rather tend to think of everything in terms of monetary values. And that's something that we haven't done in the past. It's just like a hiccup in history that we're doing that. This is this in this age. And as Margaret Mead, a really renowned anthropologist, said, this is a very anomalous time in which we live in, because we have never lived like this before, and we cannot comprehend what lies ahead of us, and we cannot understand what our ancestors lived before us, because this is an anomaly, and we cannot understand other cycles with this frame of mind, the one we have nowadays.
When I think about the ways that this displacement, you know, the way that repetitions of our, patterns as we become adapted, perhaps, to not just the cycles of crisis, the cycles of repression and oppression that a capitalist system entails. I think about what people in Africa calls the politics of the stomach, and when we move beyond just being these malleable subjects, being controlled by the material conditions, and dare to imagine, a different constellation of power, a different kind of power outside of capitalist, orientation. What do we see? What do we find? What can we learn from the mature cultures of the South, the Aymara people, the Quechua, the Maya?
In the South, we've been resisting for over 500 years the imposition of colonial rule, and we have been struggling very hard not to forget the teachings that our ancestors have handed us. It's been a huge battle because, the imposition of the colonial state, more importantly, the imposition of the colonial mind, has been something quite important in us trying to recuperate and to live our ancestral ways. And even here, I live in Arua on Anishinaabe territory, which was never ceded or unceded. And here, the Anishinaabe people, they used to live their lives according to the seven teachings of the seven grandfathers. But with the imposition of the colonial mind, my brothers and my sisters from the Anishinaabe nations are forgetting these teachings, and rather they believe that they can live their lives, their indigenous lives, according to capitalist prerogatives within the colonial states. And they have forgotten that they have a very wise set of teachings that can guide actually not only Anishinaabe people, but people anywhere on the planet. With the work I am doing with some elders of this land and other lands, we are trying to put together all the teachings that our ancestors kept for us so we can create a community in which we can live and we can coexist well. And this implies that we need to live in harmony with everything that surrounds us, all the animals, all the living systems, and that's why I think one of the biggest teachings that we can recuperate from these nations is the wheel of life, in which all nations are giving their vision to the whole community, and by sharing this common knowledge, we are going to put together a very important map for the whole humanity. This coming month in October, there is going to be the People's Conference in Bolivia about climate change, because the developed countries, they haven't been able to give a prudent response to the climatic crisis. So the peoples of the world, they are getting together again in Bolivia to give a compass to the whole humanity about what we need to do to get rid of the capitalist system and to empower not only indigenous peoples, but peoples everywhere on the planet to get rid of what is destroying their social tissue as well as their environment, which is capitalism, and to provide a new set of guidelines and a new set of objectives to live and coexist well.
I want to really emphasize that, because for most of us, we are told that if we're indigenous people, we must be spiritually oriented, and that politics are something that sort of almost tarnishes our spirituality. And I wonder if we could talk about that, because what I'm seeing is that for mature cultures like the Aymara, the Quechua, the Mayan, resistance means both, taking a political stance to protect the lands, also taking a spiritual journey to remember who we are, to remember our cultures, our songs, our poetry, our music, our art. But the two are not inseparable. The two are mutually informing and forming. So can we talk about the importance of political participation? Because a lot of people think that their only role is to simply become aligned to, you know, this relationship with nature, and that everything else will take care of itself. But what you're pointing out is that there is a responsibility, an ability to respond that we are being called to.
Yeah. The highest form of political participation is when one is empowered spiritually, in spiritual terms. You cannot provide better for your community, but when you are spiritually responsible for your community. And this spiritual responsibility is when you acquire, when you respect the vision of your ancestors and your vision of your future generations. Both ancestors and future generations being in front of you and you taking responsibility for them. To honor your ancestors, but also to provide for your future generation, even if they are not flesh and bone nowadays. They are in the spirit world, and they are watching you. That's the biggest challenge that we have, that we need to be good ancestors for our children. And we have to leave behind a planet that is viable for them, in which they can breathe the air, they can drink with the water, and they can have blessings from the Mother Earth, so they can feed their bodies. And that's the biggest heritage that we can leave behind. And that I would say that's the biggest form of political action that we can take, being a good ancestors. And of course you can narrow it down, and you can take specific actions to become a good ancestor. Specific political actions. You have to respond to the challenge, for instance, that the Terra Sons are posing to you, future generations, and you have to take a specific action to deal with that. You have to deal with the climate change that the capitalist system is creating, and we have to take actions to defend life, and we have to provide, for our grandchildren. You know, I always repeat to my students, that if there is a single lesson they are going to take from my course or from my courses, is that they have to think about their grandchildren, and they have to walk the journey towards being good ancestors.
Thank you so much for being with us. I wonder if you could leave us with a blessing in Aymara or in English, your choice. As we move forward, I think it's important to remember that, as you point out, indigenous communities throughout the South are mobilizing, are uniting their efforts to not just remember ourselves as part of nature, but also to become good ancestors by protecting the land, by protecting and promoting governments that are people-focused, that are invested in creating a world that is sustainable for all.
Yeah, thank you, Ophelia. I would say a few words. And I am blessed to be in this land of the Anishinaabe people. And my best wishes are that I am a good ancestor for my future generations, as well as for my brothers and sisters from this sacred land. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and blessings to you. My guest is Dr. Marcelo Saavedra. He is an Aymara elder. We reached him in Ottawa.
Thanks for listening. I'm going to finish this week's show with a song called The Green and Blue by Dana Lyons. Bye for now.
Traveled far and seen the magic of this place so far away.
halfway round the world, so far from you. Ancient dancing trees, blown to perfection by a thousand years of wind. Giant rivers fall from lakes so blue. It's hard to understand. They dam a river with the glaciers almost gone. As if nothing's wrong, we march on through. Lovers in a time, the word forever is a question on the wind. 12 billion hands begin what we must. That is why, my love, we hold a candle to the eminence of night. We pass the mantle with our children's ancient right to green and blue. We rise up once again. On after the end, let's take a moment now to savor this, my friend, the green and blue. The ending of a world and the beginning of a love that never. Don't start to cry, or I'll cry too. Life will find a way, our poison prison slowly swept into the sea. Sacredness survives, and we will. That is why, my love, we hold a candle to the eminence of night. We pass the mantle with our children's ancient right to green and blue. We rise up once again, born with knowledge that the dawn will come again. Let's take a moment now to savor this, my friend. Forget that there are children everywhere, cuddling ragged bears where dreams come true. Deep beneath we know that we are better than this mess we have. Reach for the hold, and I'll lift you. And that is why my our children's ancient right to green and blue. We rise up once again. We may not live to see the dawn after the end. Let's take a moment now to savor this, my friend.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.